The notion that Israel would occupy the entire Gaza Strip, almost 2 years since the October 7th atrocity, and splitting not only his own country, in the case of Benjamin Netanyahu, but also his own cabinet. And I wonder who is qualified to speculate on what this will mean. We know what Netanyahu is saying. We also know that it may not transpire as he says it will. But rise above it and tell me what will happen.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, Keir Starmer has condemned plans by the Israeli government to escalate its offensive in Gaza. He's warned the move to occupy Gaza City will only bring more bloodshed and won't help to secure the release of Israeli hostages. It was approved by Benjamin Netanyahu's security cabinet overnight. Blake Sifton, who is following developments, says a date for the operation hasn't been made public.
It's unclear if this is a reduced version of that plan that he announced yesterday to take all of Gaza, or whether this is only the first phase. Now, Gaza City is, of course, the largest city in Gaza. It's home to some 800,000 Palestinians, and they would need to be evacuated, and they would be pushed south.
The Foreign Secretary David Lammy will discuss Gaza and Ukraine with J.D. Vance later. Mr. Lammy is due to host the U.S. Vice President at Chevening, his official country house in Kent, during Mr. Vance's holiday in Britain. Their talks follow reports Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin could meet within days. A four-year-old boy has died after he was hit by a bus outside a hospital in Kent. It happened outside the Queen Elizabeth the Queen Mother Hospital in Margate yesterday afternoon. A chief constable has backed the decision by Warwickshire Police not to publish details of two rape suspects' backgrounds. It follows allegations of a cover-up by the reform leader of Warwickshire County Council. The men had been charged with the rape of a 12-year-old girl in Nuneaton. Craig Guildford, who leads neighbouring West Midlands Police, has told LBC he'd have done the same.
We're always striving to be transparent in everything that we do, but we're governed by rules. Rules are often set by Parliament, they're set by the CPS, the courts. We have to be really careful that we do follow the rules and we don't just make rules up as we go along. So that particular debate at the moment, and I spoke to my colleague next door in Warwickshire, he's followed the rules, he's done the right thing. At the moment, the rules are under review.
The independent MP, Rupert Lowe, has admitted mistaking a charity rowing crew for small boat migrants. Mr. Lowe, formerly of Reform UK, posted a picture on social media with the caption, "Dinghies coming into Great Yarmouth right now." He's since made a donation to the rowers' charity, but says he won't apologise for being vigilant. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was up 10 at 91.10. The pound buys $1.34 and a euro 15. LBC weather, most of the country will be dry with sunny spells today. Some rain in northern Scotland, a high of 26 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
So, what are you watching at the moment?
Squid Game, Dad.
Let's watch it together this weekend. That'd be nice. What's it on again?
Netflix. You've got EETV, so you just switch it on.
What season are we up to?
Four. That's Stranger Things, Mum.
And what about the kids?
Don't worry, they'll watch Cocomelon for the 100th time.
Switch on Netflix with EETV. Plus, change up sports and entertainment. It's TV with the ultimate flex for the whole family.
EETV requires EE broadband. Separate 24-month contracts for TV and broadband. Content may vary, terms apply.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It is 3 minutes after 10 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. It's hard to know which headline to start with. If we start at home, then it would be with Keir Starmer's fairly impassioned call upon the Israeli government not to further escalate its offensive in Gaza. If we were to begin in Israel, it would probably be the headline that states Israeli military chief warns against widening war. And if we were to step back from national politics and look at the world as a whole, then it would be the United Nations echoing both of those calls, the calls from the Israeli military chief and indeed from the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. But if we've learned anything over the course of the last 2 years, we have learned that Benjamin Netanyahu will not heed any warnings or indeed threats, particularly as long as he has the full-throated support of the President of the United States of America, which somewhat improbably is still Donald Trump. And so the decision yesterday to announce a full occupation of Gaza, a new military push in a part of the world that is already more or less razed to the ground. Some of the footage coming in from the planes that have been dropping aid. I lack the vocabulary sometimes to describe things, because if I say it looks like something out of a film or it looks like something out of a science fiction entertainment, it dilutes the gravity of the situation. It dilutes the horror. It's not a film. It's not dystopia. It's not science fiction. It's real. And it is happening. I felt a bit like that on October the 8th, 2 years ago, when you just tried to find the words to describe the hideousness of what you witnessed that day. But goodness me, if we manage to find those words, I'm not sure we can find the right words to describe what has already happened. And so the announcement against both domestic and international opposition, I'm not sure anybody is supportive of this plan except the United States of America, that they are going to take over Gaza City, that there is to be a de facto full occupation of the entire region, and then, and this is the bit that perhaps stretches credulity, and then there'll be a withdrawal so that the region is replaced or the region is subsequently governed by Arabs, by Palestinian people. The British ambassador to Israel, Simon Walter, said that this would be a huge mistake. He's also pushed back against the obviously ludicrous claim that recognition of Palestinian statehood by the UK would somehow be a reward for Hamas. Mick Huckabee, whose support for Israel is absolutely undilutable, has said the Israeli government should be free to do whatever they want. It's not our job to tell them what they should or should not do, which makes you wonder what the job of a US envoy is. And noted that moment. What is your job then, Mick, if it's not to put pressure on foreign governments to do what you consider to be right? I suppose if you do consider it to be right but don't want to say so, then suggesting that... What's the job of a US envoy if it isn't to exert influence? It's sort of poo-pooing the existence of diplomacy, really, in a way. And see, the other piece of the jigsaw, if you like, is reported in by the BBC today in a interesting piece that states many here believe that Netanyahu is prolonging the conflict to guarantee the survival of his coalition. And this brings us back to Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, upon whom Netanyahu relies for his retention of power. And the idea that he's now going to attack the entire Gaza Strip or occupy the entire Gaza Strip simply to cling on to power, simply to appease the ultra-nationalist or far-right ministers in his own government... Even 2 years into this nightmare, that just seems to me to be too crass to be true, doesn't it? I don't know what the alternative is. The alternative is that he really has been committed to the notion of a greater Israel all along, that the reports of dreams of settling the Gaza Strip illegally, as much of the West Bank has been illegally settled, have been full and full frontal in Benjamin Netanyahu's thinking since the very beginning. The idea of securing the release of the hostages by doing a, quotes, deal, end quotes, with Hamas still gets cited by some people as a plausible alternative, but they tried that, and it was Netanyahu's decision to call time upon that process, which is why so many of the protests back in Israel are against his policies regarding and attitudes to the hostages that are still there, one of whom, of course, was photographed or a photograph released of him earlier this week that was almost impossible to contemplate, such was the state of his emaciation. So we will inevitably get into the rights and wrongs of it, and I guess that it is possible that there will be people who are fully supportive of what Netanyahu intends to do. But if I'd asked them 2 years ago, if I'd asked them 18 months ago whether or not they would be in favour of this, they'd, I think you would have insisted that not only were you not in favour of it, but also that it was absolutely impossible that this could happen. And again, the vocabulary feels inadequate. Because, you know, you might reach for the old boiled frog analogy. You do things incrementally. You turn the dial up slowly. And that way you get it to a temperature that would never have been countenanced or allowed if that had been your original announcement. You turn it up to one and then two, three, four, five. And if you'd announced on day one that we're going to go to 10 and this is what 10 looks like, a full-scale military occupation of the Gaza Strip... Well, I mean, you'd like to think that he wouldn't have been able to do it, wouldn't you? But who would have stopped him? Once Donald Trump was in the White House, who would have stopped him? Occupying the entire Gaza Strip. And how many of us actually understand what this will mean? The human beings that live there have been shunted from pillar to post. I think about this whenever we turn our attention to this story, to this tragedy. I think about what you do. It's so beyond our ken, isn't it? To... literally lose your home, to be reliant upon the elements, the kindness of strangers. And aid, of course, has been played with as almost as a tool of oppression by the Israelis, preventing aid getting into the Gaza Strip. But I just try to imagine it. It's so far away from our lived experience. The idea of your house has just been destroyed and you don't get on the phone to the Norwich Union. You don't get on the phone to the PRU. Contact your insurers and ask where they're going to put you up for the night. Well, we could put you up we could rent you a house, I suppose, just nearby. Kids have got to get to school, so we'll try and make sure it's in the catchment. I mean, how alien is that experience from what is happening in Gaza? And now we are, what's the word I'm looking for? Calmly? I don't know if calmly is the right word, but matter-of-factly discussing the possibility that, quotes, they haven't been punished enough, end quotes. Like we're going to go into what's left. We're going to go into what remains of that benighted region. And we're going to take over. Oh, but don't worry, because we'll give it back afterwards. I'm not going to tell you to whom, but we will, I promise. You can trust me. Whew. What does it mean, then? I mean, can I ask you what you think is going to happen? 61,000 dead. Already, probably much more, because if you've seen the state of the rubble and the destroyed buildings, the likelihood of there being many, many more bodies hidden beneath the rubble seems to me to be fairly high. The notion that the retaliation for the events of October the 7th is morally or politically justified is what keeps Benjamin Netanyahu in power. But the people keeping him in power are very much of the view that Arabs have no business being in Gaza at all. They're the people keeping him in power. I sometimes feel that we've completed the jigsaw together in recent months, in the last year, let's say. I sometimes feel that we've completed the jigsaw together and we've sort of expected everybody else to see what we can see, and yet they can't. So you begin to wonder whether you've got some of the pieces wrong. The two men who keep Netanyahu in power have publicly defended expelling all Palestinians from Gaza, which is, however you cut it, the forced displacement of civilians, which is a war crime. So Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich have essentially called for Gaza to be resettled with Israeli people or with Jewish people. But they have stated with Jewish people, actually. Israeli people is my interpretation of the story. So the two people keeping him in power, this is what I mean about the jigsaw. The two people keeping him in power want Gaza to be resettled with Jewish men and women, Jewish families, right? I think illegally, under international law, but it hasn't really prevented similar settlements taking place in the West Bank. The two people keeping him in power want Gaza want Palestinians to be expelled from Gaza and the entire region to be, quotes, resettled, end quotes, with Jewish people. That's what Ben-Gvir and Smotrich are calling for. Those are the words that they use. And Netanyahu is now going to occupy the entire strip with a detail-free promise that they will afterwards hand over power. They'll tell you who they won't hand power to. They obviously won't hand it to Hamas, and obviously nor should they, but they won't hand it to the Palestinian Authority either, which is the body governing the illegally occupied West Bank that actually recognises Israel. So we'll definitely let someone else govern it, but we can't. But they go to a different school. But I can't get past the bit about who keeps him in power. The coalition collapses without the support of Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. And these two men have called for the expulsion of all Palestinians from Gaza and the entire region to be resettled by Jewish people. And what changes after the occupation? Do they suddenly change their mind? Or does Benjamin Netanyahu suddenly decide that he doesn't want to stay in power? You see what I mean about the jigsaw? And about the weird sense that this is actually pretty bloody obvious now. Why are some people pretending not to see it? Well, the short answer to that is because many people are still not prepared to come out and say, I agree with Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. I too feel that all Palestinians should be removed from Gaza and that the area should be resettled. Settled. Occupied. Let's get the language right. Should be occupied by Jewish people. I'm not prepared to come out and say that because that is at the very least ethnic cleansing, and for most scholars of the working in this area, it fits the criteria of genocide, the mass expulsion of people. It certainly fits the criteria of a war crime, according to most, if not all, scholars on that subject. So what's supposed to change after the occupation that these two characters in the coalition suddenly say, oh no, we don't want the expulsion of all Palestinian people after all, and we won't collapse your government by withdrawing our support? I think that's why Keir Starmer, for many people belatedly, has found some resolve. I don't know. One of the constant refrains in the conversations we've had about this subject, and my goodness me, we've had a few, one of the constant refrains, for which I make no apology, has been the impossibility of pinpointing pivots. We mentioned the Irish government and the Spanish government who moved on Valentine's Day of 2024 to adopt the sort of position that other countries have adopted subsequently. But for many, that was too early. Ireland has, and don't shoot the messenger, lads, Ireland has a particularly tricky relationship with anti-Semitism from dating back to the Second World War and beyond. And so seeing them as paragons of virtue when it comes to criticizing Israel is a little bit simplistic. But most people recognize that the pivot point has been reached and has been passed when the actions of Netanyahu and the IDF in Gaza became unconscionable and indefensible. Keir Starmer has arrived at that point. And, of course, Netanyahu's response is to escalate the offensive that has already been internationally condemned. I'll read you his statement because I think it's important. The Israeli government's decision to further escalate its offensive in Gaza is wrong, and we urge it to reconsider immediately. This action will do nothing to bring an end to this conflict or to help secure the release of the hostages. It will only bring more bloodshed. Every day, the humanitarian crisis in Gaza worsens, and hostages taken by Hamas are being held in appalling and inhuman conditions. What we need is a ceasefire, a surge in humanitarian aid, the release of all hostages by Hamas, and a negotiated solution. Hamas can play no part in the future of Gaza and must leave as well as disarm. Together with our allies, we are working on a long-term plan to secure peace in the region as part of a two-state solution and ultimately achieve a brighter future for Palestinians and Israelis. But without both sides engaging in good faith in negotiations, that prospect is vanishing before our eyes. Oh, I'll read that again. That prospect is vanishing before our eyes. Our message is clear. A diplomatic solution is possible, but both parties must step away from the path of destruction. The question I don't want to ask you is whether or not people like Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich and quite possibly Benjamin Netanyahu want that prospect to vanish before our eyes. If you are committed to the settlement or the occupation of Gaza and the expulsion of all Palestinians, then the last thing you want is a two-state solution. The last thing you want is a brighter future for Palestinians and Israelis, because you don't want Palestinians to be part of that future at all. And these aren't just like fringe politicians. These are the people propping up Netanyahu's administration. The people without whom he's out. He's not just out of power, he's most certainly in court the next day. So what is the plan? What is supposed to happen once the occupation is complete if these two men are still keeping him in power? 19 minutes after 10 is the time. 03456060973 is the number. I don't think I can go any deeper today than this. What's going to happen? When? Please God, if. But it's looking like when. Netanyahu defies his own military chief, defies the United Nations, defies the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, defies almost the entire world, bar Donald Trump, and occupies the whole of Gaza. Shunts what's left of the population from the tents and the scant shelter that they currently enjoy into yet more uncertainty and misery. What will actually happen? And can you unravel that riddle of how on earth he can be intending to hand Gaza to the Palestinians if his entire rationale for occupying is to keep the men calling for the expulsion of all Palestinians sweet? You've listened to this introduction. I'm just mentioning this in the context of some of the things that I occasionally point out to you. I just want you to know the kind of messages that come into the program. 21 minutes after 10 is the time. Debbie's been in touch to say, you're 20 minutes into your monologue and you have not mentioned Hamas even once. I know we plug it mercilessly, but that's because it's a brilliant piece of technology. But Global Player, the LBC app, has an opportunity for you to press rewind, listen back to live radio, and count. But the question I have for you now is very simple. What is going to happen? And what is Benjamin Netanyahu's plan? 03456060973.
LBC.
And now the weather. Scattered showers will give way to more scattered showers, but there may be a period in between where it's just grey. It's always grey, isn't it? That's why I travel with Monzo. I can use my card to spend abroad with no fees, so I can plonk myself on a beach far away from grey and spend with my Monzo card like I never left home. Hello, Beach Bar. Now to Liam for the sport. Monzo, the bank made for travel. UK residents, T's and C's apply.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. Holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ADVICE to 78900. That's ADVICE to 78900.
The advert looked genuine. A post from a household name. Experts in money. A hot opportunity. They asked for a small amount. Promised a great return. Took all I had. And then disappeared. Investment scammers are highly sophisticated. And every month, CEL talk to thousands of people like you who've fallen victim. Our experts can help recover your money. So head to celsolicitors.co.uk today.
CEL. This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
23 minutes after 10. A little more detail on some of the things that I have said. Israel's military chief warned against a full takeover of Gaza. It was reported 2 days ago, according to three Israeli sources familiar with the discussion. CNN, Reuters, all reporting that chief of staff, the IDF chief of staff, Lieutenant General A.L. Zamir had cautioned that fully conquering Gaza would trap the military within the enclave and put the remaining hostages at risk. He said such a move would also increase the burden on Israeli forces when the military is already suffering from attrition and burnout rates among reservists. And that is part of the problem that we're trying to unravel today, of course, which is that if he is planning to do this solely to stay in power and keep the likes of Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich sweet, then the rest of us are left with the horrible, horrible question of what will actually happen, because it seems at least unlikely that the intention truly is to replace the current administration, which was voted in about 20 years ago, with a currently unspecified Palestinian government. All he's told us is that it won't be the Palestinian Authority that currently governs the occupied West Bank and recognises Israel. Is it too big a question? Is it too apocalyptic, this? What is going to happen? I mean, the only answer we've got at the moment comes from the head of the actual IDF, who believes that it will be disastrous, who believes that it will see potentially the Israeli forces trapped, if you like. The plan for encircling Gaza City and other neighbourhood in which hostages might be held is what appears to have been signed off yesterday, and the head of the Israeli military is calling for it not to happen. He seems to be the only person who's got a really detailed account of what is likely to transpire if the takeover of Gaza continues. And if you're not paying any attention to him, who are you going to pay attention to? It would trap the military within the enclave and put the remaining hostages at risk, the sources said. And on we go, 26 minutes after 10. The phone lines are open on this. You know, more than likely, you know more about it than I do, but the question of what is going to happen next, what this will actually mean, is one that no one can answer definitively, but which I invite you to answer honestly, according to your understanding of the issues and the scenario. 0345 6060973 is the number you need. Richard is in Bradford. Richard, what would you like to say?
Right. My father, he served as his national service in 1947 upon the creation of Israel. And at the time, it was all called Palestine. The whole country was called Palestine. Yep. And it was decided by France, the UK and America that it would become a new state for the Jews who were refugees. Obviously,
I'm going to nudge you, if I may, towards 2025. I'm grateful for the history lesson. Right. I truly am. But most people listening will be aware of it. What do you think is going to happen if or when Benjamin Netanyahu presses ahead with a plan condemned by his own Israeli military chief to essentially encircle Gaza City and occupy the entire region?
It will finish up purely in bloodshed and famine. There cannot be any other way. He's purely saving his own neck, because when he loses his prime ministership, he will then have political and legal people looking for his head.
Yes.
And that he cannot afford.
Famine and bloodshed.
Whilst the people of Gaza are starving, he's living in luxury.
So are we, I suppose, Richard, aren't we? I mean, I know that we're not involved in what is going on, but I don't know that in times of war, a comparison between the living conditions of the participants is enormously illuminating, but I understand why you've said it. Can we be more specific than famine and bloodshed, do you think, or is it too soon to speculate?
No, I believe he's not looking for the release of the hostages. He's looking for more and more continuous ways of, just keeping on with further war efforts, just for his own sole benefit.
Listen, it's a phone-in show. Anybody who is unhappy with or objects to Richard's analysis is welcome to get in touch. But I think it is that jigsaw again. You put the jigsaw together and it's possible that you've got some of the pieces in the wrong place, but it doesn't look like it, because as long as you have two men who have publicly called for or at least defended the expulsion of Palestinians from Gaza and the settlement of the area, occupation of the area, the replacement of Palestinians with Jewish people, propping up the entire government, then the idea that Netanyahu is moving closer to doing what they call for every month, every week, every day, in order to sustain their support and stay in power, is for me at least, and for Richard, almost impossible to challenge. But you are, of course, welcome to challenge it. The problem we've got is I don't know that I want to countenance the argument that we have to do it. We have to occupy the, you know, the sort of Ben-Gavir or Smotrich spokespeople. I don't know that many people in this country, even if they thought it in their private moments, if they were in favour of it in their private moments, yes, I do think we should illegally occupy the entire Gaza Strip and expel all the Palestinians. I hope this doesn't make me sound unprofessional, but I don't know that I've got the stomach to listen to that today. Maybe I do. Maybe I need to. If that is your position, then you know the number. But the problem is, of course, that's not a counter to what Richard has said. It's actually a kind of agreement with it. He will not rest until Palestine, until Gaza has been stripped of all Palestinian people and the entire population has been replaced with Jewish people, and the notion of a greater Israel, which is what people like Ben-Gavir and Smotrich dream of, has either been achieved or come considerably closer. I don't know what a challenge to that argument looks like. It's as if there are three strands to this. Richard's highlighted one of them, which is the idea that everything is understandable by understanding Netanyahu's relationship with power and the men that keep him in there. What they want becomes the only path he can go down to keep power. Challenging that, which the head of the IDF has reportedly done, gets overridden and bulldozed out of the way because the prioritization is power. And all you can do is either support, you can either deny observable reality or support the expulsion of all Palestinians, the forced displacement of civilians. Which arguably has already happened, but which under the terms of an actual expulsion of Palestinians from Gaza would be impossible even to quibble. 0345 6060 973. What is going to happen? Are we too frightened to contemplate it, or are we just too honest to pretend that we know? Thomas Watts is here with your headlines.
Sir Keir Starmer has urged the Israeli government to think again before starting a new offensive in Gaza. Benjamin Netanyahu's security cabinet has approved plans to occupy Gaza City, which could displace tens of thousands more people. A four-year-old boy has died after being hit by a bus outside a hospital in Kent. Police were called to the collision outside the Queen Elizabeth Queen Mother Hospital in Margate yesterday afternoon. People living near new pylons could get £250 a year off their energy bills for a decade. The government hopes the cash benefit will reduce local opposition to electricity infrastructure. LBC weather, much of the UK dry with some good sunny spells. Rain in northern Scotland, a high of 26 degrees.
This is LBC.
Emma from Leeds. Talk to me.
Sir, I had two doubles, but Claire had five. And it's not like I'm there counting. Well, OK, I guess I am. But for her to want me to pay half the bill when
I'm losing it. Doubles. She should just do what I do. Bank with Monzo and share the bill in the app. Split it fairly down to the dough ball and get paid straight away. Easy.
And she had tiramisu.
Monzo. Split bills in seconds. UK residents, T's and C's apply.
So, where are we going?
You wanted to try something new? Well, we're here.
The Hyundai Electrifying Summer Event.
I booked a test drive in the all-new Insta online. It's the 2025 World Electric Vehicle winner, and we save £500 if we order before the 31st of August.
Ooh, very stylish.
Oh, and it's Hyundai, by the way.
The Hyundai Electrifying Summer Event. Are you in? 18 plus UK retail customers only. Excludes Motability. Registered by 30th of September. T's and C's apply.
When you go abroad, everyone knows the best way to make yourself understood is to just say everything in English, but louder.
Four beers, please, garçon!
If only there was a way that could work with your advertising campaign. Well, there is. And you're listening to it. Because when you amplify your advertising with radio, 40 million listeners every week get the message. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold.
holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ADVICE to 78900. That's ADVICE to 78900.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
It is 10:34 and we are in the midst of what I mean, hope is not quite the right word to use, but what I hope, in a sense, will be the most horrific territory that we ever discuss together. But on an incredibly, I mean, an immeasurably lighter note, why do you think I am currently, or have this morning, not necessarily currently, I have this morning been looking at where Great Yarmouth is on a map? Any guesses on this? Anyone? Bueller? I mean, whether or not you want to bring the Hanseatic League into your contemplations is, of course, up to you. I think I've got that right. Is it the Hanseatic League? But anyway, we'll may return to that territory or answer that question a little later. It's a question. I mean, I don't think anybody can accuse the head of the IDF of being anti-Semitic, and he is reportedly passionately opposed to Benjamin Netanyahu's plan to occupy the whole of Gaza. So the question of what is likely to happen and what is actually happening are questions that I don't know who can answer them. The only person who's offered up an answer so far to what is likely to happen that I can find is the head of the IDF, and he says it's going to be awful. So how can anyone be in favour of it? What do you think will transpire? Mo's in Birmingham. Mo, what do you reckon?
Hello, James. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I think Bibi Netanyahu, in this current iteration of the Israeli government, desires forever war. I think forever war suits their agenda. Now, in the case of Bibi, it obviously keeps him in power. He doesn't want to go to jail. He enjoys the trappings and the glory of the prime ministerial office and of the perks that are provided by that, be that cigars or holidays or whatever else. He enjoys all of that.
Well, so would you, I imagine. I mean, you know, not to make light of it at all, but I think it's more staying out of jail, probably, than it is cigars, isn't it?
Yeah, but he enjoys the glory and the glamour, and I think the perks of the power. There's nothing that suggests otherwise. Now, in regards to the segments of his government, now, again, harking back to the two ministers, Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir,
yes,
they are, I think, firmly wedded to the idea of a greater Israel. And I think this is the more sinister part of it, and this is why the forever war suits their agenda. They don't mind this wave of anti-Semitism that is sweeping across the globe.
You think?
They are forcing Jews abroad, in America, in Britain, in Europe in general, to make a decision to say, do you want to stay in an environment that is becoming increasingly hostile to you, or come to Israel and we'll provide you with the additional land for you to make your new life in. And that additional land, I think, comes from reoccupying Gaza.
Well, then you forgive me, you know what I'm like. I'm going to pick holes in everything, but you can't have it both ways. That would be something that could only be achieved in the absence of perpetual war.
But you need war to occupy the territory.
Yeah, but not if
you
it's perpetual, Mo.
The boundaries.
I hope I'm not. I don't think I'm being pedantic. I really don't. But it's possible. It's possible I am. But because I mean, perpetual war might suit some of the parties in this process. I don't think it suits people who actually want to occupy Gaza forever.
You make a valid point here.
Thank you.
But the perpetual war, and because Israel is the dominant military power in the region,
yes,
and because it would be opponents around that area are so cowed and meek as compared to Israel, that perpetual war entails expanding borders. Who would have thought 2 years ago, that 3 years ago, that Israeli troops would be within 1 hour of central Damascus,
yeah,
or control areas of Lebanon, or able to exercise increased air dominance over even territories like Iraq, for example, you know, the way they achieve their air war against Iran. They are constantly looking to increase their borders here, and so that perpetual war involves expansion.
Okay, so you can have both. You can have constant pushing at the boundaries or the borders, and we've seen maps. Senior Israeli politicians have appeared in public with them, and that would be a form of perpetual war, but the quote successfully occupied end quotes territory could simultaneously be settled.
And just to, I think, go back to it, where there were previous discussions here, and I don't know whether you've missed this or not in the news, where there were previous discussions of forcing the Palestinians into Jordan or Egypt, say, for example, the current prevailing idea is that actually they will be moved more further afield to areas like Puntland. You know, the secessionist area. It's the secessionist area of Somalia, which they are currently campaigning with Trump to say that, look, we will do all manner of things in terms of working alongside the Americans and so on if you recognize our independence from Somalia.
I didn't know that, mate. I apologize.
And, you know, one of the things mooted, and it's a thing that I've forgotten the newspaper in which the discussion is held in the last day, is that they've mooted the idea of taking an unspecified number of Gazan Palestinians.
I'm not across that, and I don't know whether I should be or not. I don't know how widely it has been reported, but it speaks to the notion of the two things you describe happening simultaneously, which would be, and again, you know, if we were to be able to speak to Benjamin Netanyahu, and if he were to agree with your analysis, the argument, the defence, the justification would be that it ensures the security of Israelis. It ensures the security of Israel. The only way we can be safe is to do these things. And there are people who believe that. And, you know, you can't 100% prove that they're wrong. So two things can be true at the same time. They're doing something that you consider to be unconscionable and indefensible and almost certainly in breach of international law. And other people believe that it is the only course of action to be taken if all that you care about is the protection of Israel and the protection of people in Israel. Thank you, Mo. And I'll look up that thing. What was it called?
Puntland. Puntland.
How do you spell that? You can tell this is live. Yeah. You can tell this. Go on, P.
No, it's okay. Puntland.
Thank you.
And so we've got an American government at the moment that is talking with a country that does not exist, but that wishes to exist, and that country that doesn't exist at the moment is floating a load of ideas to obviously
because
help
these
its
poor people
come into place.
Because whoever is left will have to go somewhere. And if the plan of Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich and others is to be realised, and quite possibly Benjamin Netanyahu, at the moment, no one has actually got any particular plan on where they will end up. It is 10:41. Oh, Naz is in Enfield. Naz, what would you like to say?
I'd like to say, you know, from the beginning, I used to speak to you and say this was the idea, but now it's happening. It's very frightening that this is allowed to, this will be allowed to, so is the world just going to stop and just watch this?
I don't know.
Are they going to do something? Because now it's coming into a different, you know, it's heartbreaking. It's coming to a different thing completely. First, it was, you know, that Israel has to defend itself.
Yes.
But now, if they're ethnic cleansing or whatever they're doing, and they're pushing the people out, surely it's time for the UN or peacekeeping troops or someone to stop Israel, because otherwise if they get away with it, who's to say what will happen with other countries going into it? It's gone beyond anything that people were thinking beyond, you know.
Did you say 18 months ago that this is what you feared or that this is what you thought would happen? That it's impossible to see the circumstances in which Netanyahu would stop. He made it clear long ago that even the full release of the hostages would not bring about a ceasefire or a cessation of hostilities in Gaza. So where will he stop is an impossible question to answer. What will he do next?
Yes.
If you'd said 12 months ago he will occupy the entire Gaza Strip, I think people would have poo-pooed that, would they?
No, yes, definitely. Everybody was saying, you know, oh, he wouldn't dare do that. But I think he's had this greater Israel plan right at the beginning. And, we see the pictures every day. There's photos every day. There's social media every day of what's happening, famine, children starving. And now it's gone to it. So I find it strange that nobody's saying, well, we can't let this go on. I mean, it's
well, they are, but it's only words.
It's only words. That's what I mean.
I can't believe we're quoting Boyzone in such a serious conversation. There.
Yes.
But it is. It is only words.
It is only words. Sure. If it was another place, I think people would be more would call for action. But because it's Israel, no one's saying anything. Like they're condemning everybody. I'm not saying they're not saying anything, but surely, you know, like in Bosnia, we had to have peacekeeping troops. Mm. But surely there should be something, because the people would be fit. You know, they've had everything done to them, everything that could possibly happen.
And Mo was right. I've checked, and the story has been around since February. Israeli and US officials are reportedly looking into Morocco, as well as two autonomous regions of Somalia, as potential destinations for relocating Gazans under President Trump's proposed plan to move Gazans from the war-torn enclave. I remember elements of that story. I'm sorry that I missed the bit where they actually gave a name to the places to which they would move these people. I wonder if it would qualify as a sort of second Nakba, as if it would be a repetition of what happened to many of their forebears in 1948, but which, of course, would not involve moving to neighbouring territory from their family homes. It would involve moving to continents away. And that's been reported. That's why I said that phrase earlier. Thank you, Naz. The phrase was matter-of-factly. We're having these conversations matter-of-factly. I don't know how else to have them. You can't have them hysterically, because you lose the room. It's not linked in any way except through Donald Trump, but there's also a story around at the moment about them reviewing science. I know we reach for George Orwell, and I know we probably have reached for him too much over the years, but they are literally reviewing science from an entirely unscientific perspective. The Trump administration is rewriting past climate reports, essentially to erase scientific history and undermine the consensus on human-caused climate change. We are matter-of-factly discussing, Mo was, and I am now, the possibility of airlifting every person in Gaza to Somaliland. And again, we're back to the observation that if anybody had suggested that this was on the horizon 6 months ago, 12 months ago, 18 months ago, even in the immediate aftermath of Hamas's hideous terror attack of October the 7th, I think you would have been laughed out of town. I think if you did suggest that this was the likely direction of traffic, I think you probably were laughed out of town. But no one's laughing now. It's 10:47.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC. She's the only fan star that's got everybody talking.
She's making a living out of disgusting men.
It's just completely sick, and she's deluded herself into thinking it's a good idea.
Now it's time to hear from the woman who gained international notoriety after sleeping with 1,000 men in a day.
I'm just a girl, I'm relatable, I'm sort of the girl next door vibes, and I want people to be able to watch my videos and be able to imagine themselves in it.
Bonnie Blue joins me, Tom Swarbrick, for a tell-all interview. Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on your radio, on Global Player, and the new LBC app.
What makes matchday? You know Maggie's cap is the vibe.
Mate, piking all day, every day.
Mark, the cabbie, bigger fan than we are.
Banging out some Not the Top 20 on the way to the game.
It's a great podcast.
All the expert pundits down a dog and duck.
Oh, Kebab Palace, he gets the chili garlic ratio spot on.
Match Day is about more than just the game. It's an experience shared with local businesses at the heart of every EFL club and community. That's why we're proud to support the businesses behind the badge. Sage, official accounting software partner of the EFL.
Because you never know what little pickles will get themselves into. For pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
Do it for your wife, who told you to pick up bread, but instead you picked up Fred, your grandson. Again. And now your daughter is calling because he missed football. That's the fourth time this month. You can wave his future career goodbye. If you don't do it for you, do it for your wife and little Freddie.
Book a free hearing test today at bootshearingcare.com and save up to £300 with our free technology upgrade. Boots. With you. For life. T's and C's apply. See website for details.
Save this summer
with Lidl Plus. Get 2 for £7 on burgers, jumbo sausages and more. And get 2 for £3.50 on our plant burgers, veggie sausages and more veggie classics. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this summer today.
18 plus TV only while stocks last. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
Who's a good human? Jenny is, because Jenny will always do what's best for Bertie, her bestie Bassett. So if Bertie needs to go and wee, that's what they're going to do. Even if it is 3 a.m. and it's raining cat lots. That's why she also chooses Butternut Box for Bertie's meals. Freshly prepared, served straight from the fridge, and conveniently delivered right to your door. At a time that suits you for once. Hey, Jenny. Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, tap up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
It is 10 to 11 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Where I did know bits about this, but no one's perfect. Bits slip through the net sometimes and you get distracted and your focus is never exclusively on one subject. In fact, apropos some of the things that we're discussing today, I really could not... I mean, I don't know if recommend is the right word, but there is an extraordinary account in the Guardian today by one of the best journalists in the business, Mark Townsend, who has unearthed the full horrible details about a potential massacre that unfolded in Sudan's largest displacement camp in April. If the details are confirmed, it would become the biggest war crime of that country's catastrophic conflict. And the investigation by Mark Townsend and colleagues into the 72-hour attack by the paramilitary rapid support forces on North Darfur's Zamzam camp is absolutely harrowing and a reminder that while Israel remains our ally, And therefore our focus will be on the actions of an ally much more than on the actions of a rogue regime. The horrors that are being witnessed in Gaza and horrors that may get worse are by no means confined to that part of the world. It's a really, really powerful piece of journalism. And also somewhat hindered by the difficulty of getting into a region, which draws another parallel, of course, with Gaza, which Benjamin Netanyahu is determined to occupy, despite objections of almost the entire world. But the thing for which I am apologising a little bit is the my failure to clock until Mo explained it to us, just how far down the road they have gone when it comes to possible relocation of Palestinians. An organisation called the Boston Consulting Group modelled relocating Palestinians to Somalia and Somaliland during a project on post-war Gaza. The Financial Times reports today, in fact, according to people familiar with the work, with multiple potential destinations being listed in a complex spreadsheet created on behalf of Israeli business people who were sketching plans for the redevelopment of Gaza after the war between Hamas and Israel. As I say, I'm reading verbatim from yesterday's Financial Times. So Mo there giving us a bit of a heads up on something we probably should have been aware of. David is in Cheltenham. David, what would you like to say?
Good morning, James.
Hello, David.
I think if this goes ahead, this plan from Netanyahu's current government, it'll be the end of Israel. The end.
Really?
Yes, it's going to be that drastic, I think.
Why do you think
that? Because he's a war criminal. Netanyahu has been named as a war criminal, and he'll end up in prison eventually. Trump will not be here forever.
Because the vacuum would be left if Netanyahu was removed. I think he's been accused of war crimes. I mean, he has to go on trial and be convicted before you can say that he's been found.
The Hague want him.
But to put him on trial for war crimes, it's not a.
Yeah, but there are survivors of the Holocaust who don't agree with Netanyahu or his government.
No, of course there are. We've spoken to some of them. But I just yes. Wonder about the leap from all of that, which is observably true, to the existential threat to Israel that this escalation in Gaza would... You're not the only person who thinks it. I'm just wondering what backs it up.
I just feel that when Israel was created, this was not the end game, not the end plan for Israel, was it? They've overstepped the mark.
Well, there are plenty of people who've wanted a two-step solution over the years, but it looks as if the people who don't are in the ascendancy. And you look at the ones who are very explicit about that, like Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, and those who seem to be on side, although they're not quite as overt about their ambitions as those two men are. I it would be a mess of such incalculable proportions that nobody knows what would transpire, and Israel somehow losing it. I don't know. I can't see that myself, David. I can't quite see what would happen unless you're suggesting Israelis were chased out of the region and relocated to somewhere like Somaliland.
No, like America. Like America. Trump supports Israel.
Yes.
Against everybody else.
Yes.
Well, why not move Israel? Why not move Israel? Wouldn't that be simpler?
All views are welcome, but I can't quite join the dots of the point we're at now to the point at which you think we will end up. Not least because of simple statistics, simple logistics. You're talking about 10 million people in the context of Israel, and a fraction of that, a tenth of that, a fifth of that in the context of Gaza. But I don't know. I mean, whether or not he is exposing Israel to major danger seems fairly inarguable, but actual existential threat, I do not know. Even the Israeli military chief, who has reportedly cautioned that this would trap the military within the enclave and put the remaining hostages at risk, doesn't go as far as you do. But he does explain the burden it would put on Israeli forces, and this means that Netanyahu is minded to ignore the chief of staff, Lieutenant General Eyal Zamir, and his account of what this mission would do to his forces. Netanyahu seems minded to ignore warnings about attrition and burnout among reservists and press on regardless, for the reasons that David alludes to. No one's really disputed that a large part of Netanyahu's motivation, if not all of it, is hanging on to power. I mean, again, you can believe that's true and approve of the plans to expel all Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. But there's a little bit of me, this happens a lot when we turn our attention to this particular topic, there's a little bit of me that can't believe the evolution of the conversation, you know, from abject horror at the October the 7th atrocities undertaken by Hamas to fears at varying degrees of earliness or lateness that Netanyahu's response would be extreme. Didn't Joe Biden warn? Didn't Joe Biden say very, very early on, we picked up on this, Eleanor actually, the producer picked up on this, because I didn't really understand what he meant. Joe Biden warned Israel, he warned Netanyahu not to let this become their 9/11. In other words, not to let this terrorist atrocity spawn a response that would make everything immeasurably worse. And David's just reminded me of that. It would make everything immeasurably worse in the way that invading Iraq and many of George W. Bush's international policies made the world an immeasurably less safe place, essentially created a vacuum into which ISIS and Islamic State were able to move. And Joe Biden actually said that. Don't do what we did. I don't know that anyone could argue now that Netanyahu hasn't done exactly what Joe Biden cautioned against. Cecilia's in Salisbury. Cecilia, what would you like to say?
Well, good morning, James. I think there's one thing that you're possibly missing, and it's the most horrific thing, and that is you talked about airlifting Palestinians to Morocco and other places.
Yes.
I don't think Netanyahu has any intention of doing that. I think his intention is left for there not to be any Palestinians left to airlift. In other words, he'll wipe them all out.
Well, I don't know that there's anything beyond a gut feeling that delivers that conclusion to you. Nobody has said anything apart from some extremists talking about nuclear bombs being dropped on Gaza or people talking about there being no innocent people there. The international... The international community could not countenance that, I would argue, and you're probably going to accuse me of naivety.
Well, I'm going to say to you that at the moment, the international community, to my horror and great sadness, is countenancing the starvation and persecution of hundreds of thousands of people without moving a hand to help them.
We had this.
And you've also got to remember, if I may say,
you may.
But it was Donald Trump who said Gaza is a great piece of real estate, and I could build a wonderful resort there. And I know from people who live in the States that there are sites advertising plots, you know, overlooking the sea. So
I'm not aware of that personally. None of that supports the fear of a sort of extermination of everybody in Gaza. Well, all of that could sit alongside a relocation.
You tell me how you from what we see on a day to day basis, how the IDF are looking to preserve life. They're not. People are being shot if they go to get a bag of flour. People are being shot if they walk down the street. The people in the...
I'm not disputing any of that, but that isn't proof that they want to exterminate 2 million people.
Well...
I mean, I don't know if you heard what Netanyahu said yesterday, and this is not the first time in recent years that I've thought that the world has been taken over by the kind of people who used to ring radio programs with the most ignorant, ill-informed and dangerous opinions. But his response to the accusation of genocide was to say, well, if it was a genocide, we're not very good at it, are we? Because there's so many people left in the Gaza Strip, which demonstrates an ignorance of scholarship and an ignorance of international law so complete that I refuse to believe Benjamin Netanyahu was speaking honestly. He can't be that ignorant of genocide scholarship and international law, but it's the kind of thing that a two-bit radio presenter might say when trying to justify the kind of carnage that you describe. And now you've got the actual Prime Minister of Israel saying it. I just don't see I don't dispute anything that you've said about what has happened, but I don't see it being a proof of the inevitability of a complete wipeout of all Palestinian people. And obviously, the one thing we can agree on, Cecilia, is that we both hope you're wrong.
Oh, absolutely. Don't misunderstand me.
I don't misunderstand you at all. I just wanted to part as friends because it is the worst imaginable consequence. Although, you know, even by citing it, even by putting it on the board, you kind of add weight to, and I've had a couple of messages making this point, to the idea of a complete relocation or an absolutely state-sanctioned ethnic cleansing. Because the alternative that Cecilia has cited, or that David in Cheltenham cited from an Israeli perspective, are so much worse than the idea of just, well, why don't we just pick them all up and drop them in the middle of nowhere? It is 11:01.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, Sakir Starmer says the Israeli government is wrong to approve plans to occupy Gaza City. The Prime Minister has warned his counterpart, Benjamin Netanyahu, that a new offensive would only bring more bloodshed. It stops short of fully taking over Gaza, which the Israeli leader has touted, to defeat Hamas. LBC's correspondent in Tel Aviv, Blake Sifton, says the next steps remain unclear.
There has not yet been a call up of reservists in any serious number. And of course, an operation of this size would require a large number of Israeli reservist combat soldiers. And then, of course, there would need to be an evacuation order ordered for Gaza City. And there would have to be time for the population to move south, which is apparently the plan.
A 4-year-old boy has died after being hit by a bus outside a hospital in Kent. Police were called to the collision outside the Queen Elizabeth Queen Mother Hospital in Margate yesterday afternoon. A chief constable has told LBC that police are always striving to be transparent. Craig Guildford, who leads West Midlands Police, has backed his counterpart in Warwickshire over claims of a cover-up in a rape case. He's insisted the rules were followed when information was published about the incident in Nuneaton. People living near newly built electricity pylons could get £250 a year off their energy bills for a decade. The government plans are intended to overcome local opposition to new overhead lines. It'll apply to homes within 500 metres of pylons. Energy Minister Miatta Fanbulle has told LBC that network upgrades are essential.
We are building infrastructure. We are building the energy system of the future. And we think it's really important that people have a stake so that when development happens, when you get a pylon, you feel that you're a direct beneficiary. And that is the sort of, if you like, the return, the upside, the gains that communities have.
A yellow heat health alert's been issued across parts of England next week. The warning from the UK Health Security Agency will last from midday on Monday until Wednesday evening. It means officials are expecting health and care services to come under extra pressure. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 91.10. That is up 10 points. The pound buys $1.34 and the euro 15. LBC weather, most of the UK dry with plenty of good sunny spells. Some rain in the north of Scotland, a high of 25 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Five minutes after 11. Okay, I've cleared the switchboard now, so thank you to everybody who was waiting to contribute to the last hour of the programme. I'm staying in similar territory, but prompted, in fact, by one of the callers in the last hour, by more than one of the callers in the last hour, I'm asking a completely different question. So indulge me for a moment to get that question up and running before you answer it. So what on earth should the international community do? It's fair to say that with the exception of Donald Trump, who has an envoy who doesn't think his job is to do envoying, I mean, where does it end, eh? Mick Huckabee sound. It's not our job. I'm in Israel as an envoy for the US government, but it's not our job to seek to influence what Israel wants to do. They're free to do whatever they want to do. What's the point of having an envoy, Mickey? Oh, well, it's a good job. It's well paid. I get a lot of foreign travel. I got my own jet plane. Yeah, but you're an envoy. What does envoying mean? What does an envoy do? Well, I don't think it's my job to do anything. I'm just an envoy. I'm here to envoy. I envoy. I'm Mick Huckabee and I envoy. It's an extraordinary intervention, the more you think about it, but we're in such extraordinary times that two things occur to me. Number one, that's why I use the word extraordinary so much. But number two, we don't notice how extraordinary everything is. He literally said, it's not our job to tell them what they should or should not do. So what is your job then, Mike Huckabee? Not Mick. I don't know where I got Mick from. What is your job? So I mention all of this because it is clear, I think, that the United States isn't going to do anything. In fact, they are party to plans to relocate the entire population of Gaza to as yet undecided corners of the planet where they will be required to move whether they want to or not. You've got the breakaway region of Somaliland, Somalia itself. United Arab Emirates was on this list put together by the Boston Consulting Group, as were Egypt and Jordan. So the United States isn't going to do anything. While we've been on air, the story has assumed the sort of momentum that you would expect it to assume as the apocalyptic consequences of what has been planned and the opposition to it from within Israel, most notably from Benjamin Netanyahu's own military chief. A lot of people saying, I think you were getting him mixed up with Mick Hucknall. Mike Huckabee, Mick Hucknall. Yeah, you could be right. The opposition within Israel to it creates a new sense of jeopardy. Even though we've been chronicling these horrors for the best part of 2 years, there is a new sense of jeopardy when Netanyahu seems determined to press on with yet more violence, yet more carnage, even against the advice of some of his closest allies and his own military chief. So the reason why it's very important to establish that America will do nothing, Donald Trump will do nothing, the question of what all of these world leaders condemning his plan should do is urgent. Keir Starmer has released a statement. I have argued in the past that there's not a lot else they can do. I talked about it a little bit, and only a little bit, because it's not really what that format is about, on my Full Disclosure podcast with the Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, the idea that they could do more is one that has so far been rejected by the UK government. And the UK government is not alone. The recognition of a Palestinian state is something that both Canada and France have also moved towards, have also adopted or are imminently adopting, joining 140 plus other countries already in the United Nations. But what we have this morning is a clamour of opposition, a clamour of criticism, a clamour of condemnation of what Netanyahu is planning to do. So we tracked in the last hour the likely outcome of it, and the impossibility, really, of supporting it. But what I want to do now is articulate what opposition would look like. Keir Starmer has issued a statement, and that is diplomacy. That is international relations. In the context of an imminent genocide, or a feared genocide, or a continuing genocide, or not a genocide at all, depending upon what your perspective is, but an absolutely hideous death toll nonetheless, the idea that you simply release a statement sounds pathetic, right? At one point, at first glance, from this perspective here. What's he done? Oh, he's released a statement. How many dead? 61,000. How many more are going to die? God knows. What's he done? He's released a statement. Spain as well, of course, on the recognition of the Palestinian state list. And yet, that is what you do. This is why Mike Huckabee's comments are so hideous. Because that is what you do. Of course that is what you do. That is what international civilization looks like. That is what you do. You seek, particularly with allies, to prevent them from doing things that you consider to be at best wrong and at worst entirely unconscionable. What does ally mean? If it doesn't mean trusted friend. If it doesn't mean concerned party. Here is your friend planning to do something hideous, something you consider to be hideous. If you don't like the word hideous, let's go with dangerous. If you don't like the word dangerous, let's go with wrong. You think it's wrong. What is your job? Your job is to try to stay their hand. Mike Huckabee doesn't think that's his job. He doesn't think the job of an envoy is to envoy. He doesn't think diplomacy is the job of a diplomat. He's Donald Trump's guy, and he'll do whatever the heck he wants. And the message he's given to Benjamin Netanyahu is, hey, you do whatever the heck you want as well. So as you have international opposition to this, quote, plan, end quote, reaching fever pitch with heads of state, heads of the United Nations, head of the Israeli military, all calling for Netanyahu to stop, to stay his hand, what does more meaningful resistance look like from the international community? Come at it however you want, but don't bring America into it, because they ain't going to do anything. I think the two people who are safest on whatever course they elect to pursue on this planet at this point in time when it comes to potential US intervention are Benjamin Netanyahu and Vladimir Putin. They are the two world leaders who are free to do, for reasons I don't fully grasp, I don't know what category you slot them both into that makes Donald Trump so supportive of their various positions, but the two people who can do whatever the heck they want on any front at the moment on this planet are Netanyahu, from an American point of view, Netanyahu and Putin. So I think, and again, as ever, correct me when I'm wrong on 0345 6060973, I think that that America is off the page. I think America are out of the picture. So at 11:15 this morning, I ask you this. What can they do? The world leaders, the Keir Starmers, the Emmanuel Macrons, the Mark Carneys, the United Nations, if their determination to prevent Netanyahu from doing what he has announced he intends to do is sincere and considerable, what can they do to stop it? 0345 6060973. And You can swap the verbs out if you want. What should they do? 03456060973. What can they do? What do you want them to do? The answer might be nothing, which you're more than welcome to explain. 03456060973. It's a grim suggestion that there's nothing that can be done. But we have a history of doing nothing. Not with allies, I grant you. But we did nothing really to stop the Rwandan genocide. We did nothing really to stop what appears to have been a genocide in... I'm telling you, the one that's reported in The Guardian today, that looks like one of the worst war crimes of recent years in Sudan, in the largest displacement camp or refugee camp in Sudan. We often do nothing when truly terrible things happen. Just not when it is a historic and cherished ally that is undertaking the course of action to which we are passionately opposed. So what can we, stroke they, do? What do you want them to do? And what should they, stroke we, do? Okay? Hit the numbers now, you will get through. Very different question from the last hour. Don't turn me into a school teacher who has to start pointing out that you're not answering the question that I'm currently asking. I don't suit that role, to be honest with you, because you can come at this with things I haven't thought of and you can answer questions I haven't asked. But I am moving you now to what an international or a British response to Benjamin Netanyahu's determination to defy many of his own people, many of his own colleagues, and his own military chief. What does that determination to defy all of those people lead you to think the opponents should be doing? What does more meaningful opposition than statements and state recognitions look like? 03456060973. And listen, I don't want you to be crazy. Don't come up with really crazy things. But we are looking at a vacuum at the moment. International response to Netanyahu's determination to defy all criticism, all condemnation, all calls for calm. What on earth does a more meaningful response look like? 03456060973 is the number you need. The time is 16 minutes after 11.
LBC.
LBC is investigating the impact of over-tourism. Sheila Fogarty was joined by the UK General Manager at Intrepid Travel, Joanna Reeve.
Over-tourism is excess negative impact on a destination, something that negatively impacts the local community. We want to tackle the problem, not just pick it up and move it somewhere else. Mm. For us, our how is very much around small intimate groups.
Listen back to the full interview, thanks to Intrepid Travel, on the LBC app.
The holiday park industry is in the spotlight after thousands of holiday park homeowners lost what they...
You've heard it in the news. Holiday park homeowners being hit with sudden site fee increases, fake resale promises, and dramatic losses in the value of their holiday homes. The Holiday Park Advice Centre could help you get compensation if you were missold. Contact the Holiday Park Advice Centre today. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future, with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line, already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth Line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
18 minutes after 11 and before we wade back into some of the ugliest and most heartrending territory of our time together, a quick moment of levity. Every single person who responded to my question about why I spent 5 minutes this morning studying the coast of Norfolk, particularly Great Yarmouth, every single person who responded to that question has answered correctly. So I don't even know if I need a reveal on this, but it is a story that that would lighten the mood a little later this hour. I also want to talk to you, oddly, about Morecambe Football Club, which is in genuine jeopardy. And it strikes me that sometimes we don't cast our net wide enough outside London. It's not really a football story. It's a story about what a football club, and indeed the disappearance of a football club, can do to a town. And our friends up in Morecambe, or Morecambe, as regular listeners will know, I was encouraged to call it as a child, I thought just deserved a little bit more attention than we've paid previously. So all that's to come. Let's start on the question of what more meaningful resistance than a simple statement saying please don't do it would actually look like. Because if Keir Starmer is right and Netanyahu's plans will only, quotes, bring more bloodshed, then a piece of paper seems somewhat inadequate a response. Mujahid is in Streatham. Mujahid, what would you like to say?
Hello, James. I reckon forget speeches, forget any resistance, forget whatever. What we need to do is a state version of what Greta Thunberg did, getting food over there. What is Israel going to do if the Air Force, or if we do take military action to take food and medical aid over there? What are they going to do? Are they going
well,
to
they are. They have been doing airdrops recently.
No more.
On
an industrial scale.
That's fine, but it's not really an answer to the question of how do we stop him pursuing the full occupation of Gaza.
But let's deal with the immediacy of what's happening, the immediacy of the problem, the hunger, the lack of aid. Let's do that. Let's go over there. Let's do a military action on an industrial scale to get food and medical aid over there. Forget trying to stop him, because we're not, like you said, we can't.
I never said that.
Sorry, you didn't say all right.
I'm not picking a fight. I mean, I'm probably being naive, but I still think we can. I still think he has to be stoppable. There is no such thing in this earth as an unstoppable force.
Well, the only way of stopping is military action. I think that's going to be messy.
I don't know if it is. I mean, to be fair, don't say that, because I want to talk about this for at least another half an hour. It's not the only way. There must be lots of other things that could be done, but you've swerved.
No, but we haven't done that yet. We haven't done an industrial scale.
We need to land ships on the coast. Yes. We need to, These become provocations potentially. If Israel is saying you're not allowed to do
but
this,
what are they going to do? Attack us?
I don't know.
So let's do that first. Let's get our ships over there with food, medical aid.
So food, water, medicine, shelter. Yeah. Send out gazebos and tents and what have you.
Do an industrial scale version of what Greta Thunberg did.
Why do you keep talking about? Oh, sorry. You mean when Greta Thunberg was sailing towards Israel? Sorry, I was thinking about the climate change stuff. You threw me
Well,
that was a symbolic gesture, I think, to prove how impossible it was to actually take aid to an area from which aid had been cut off, essentially by Israel. So actually just go back down the Greta Thunberg route, but in such numbers and on such a scale that it would be impossible to arrest everybody and prevent them from delivering the aid that is so desperately needed. Again, listen, we are describing a vacuum and suggesting things that might move into it. So plausibility is not something that we can establish or define at this point, but it would be better than nothing. It would be immeasurably better than nothing. Even if it involves, as you've allowed, it involves a concession of failure, it is impossible to stop him, which I don't currently believe, but that might just make me a bit silly. Thank you, mate. Farah is in Southfields. Farah, what would you like to say?
Hi, I think it probably is something slightly similar to your caller just now, but I think it's about time that the UN member states triggered Article 51 of Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. What that allows is for the member states to put together a coalition. It's a defensive coalition that can be sent to these countries, and they can actually open up a humanitarian corridor. And you don't have to have UN Security Council approval. It's actually there so that, for example, like obviously America keeps blocking this all the time, to allow aid and help and, what people
actually need. So it can't be vetoed by the states?
It can't be vetoed. So the UN
is this what, is this what the Taoiseach
can veto the whole time.
Is this what the Taoiseach has been pursuing in Ireland?
It is.
Yes.
And I have actually Francesca Albanese's massive legal book on this whole area, so I did sort of check it, but obviously I'm not a lawyer, so I'm sure people will come back, but there is a provision there for the entire planet to be able to go to the aid of people who are suffering And what's Israel really going to do? Are they going to fire on, you know, on actual UN, you know, peacekeepers? You've had Dr. Victoria Rose on your...
I have.
You know, you'll think over and
I've
over
had Francesca Albanese on as well.
I know, massive fan, massive. My two amazing female role models. I mean, Victoria Rose was my reconstructive breast surgeon when I had cancer 5 years ago.
Gosh.
I was at the fundraiser to send her and her colleagues, her surgeons, back to Gaza. It was for Ideals, which is her charity, and Islamic Relief, which is the charity that physically gets them out there. It was a couple of weeks ago, and they were showing us, you know, cases. They're all children. She's been giving, you know, she's been at Parliament, I think, earlier on this week as well, talking about it. And she's saying, now is the time. Countries need to do it now. There is the charter there. And I know people call in and say, oh, well, we can't afford, you know, to send our forces over there. What do people think as the entire rules-based order is collapsing? What do people think is going to happen to our economies where nobody can trade, there is no trust, there is wars going over? That is a huge threat to our security.
But this is, again, you're describing a mitigation of the impact of what is planned rather than a resistance of what is planned, aren't you?
You know, the only other thing is that you go to war with Israel and the US.
That can't be the only. That can't be the only other thing. I mean, you know, again, at risk of sounding idealistic or naive, there must be more successful, more effective diplomatic channels. I mean, you know, in terms, if the United States withdrew support, then the game would change beyond all recognition. But that ain't going to happen. But it can't just be too.
Well,
can't
it's
be
got
that
to be Israelis themselves. And I have been watching hundreds of videos on loads of Israelis from all different parts of civil society saying that it has to stop, and thousands marching through Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, holding up pictures of starving Palestinian children. I think it's important to perhaps your listeners to realize that the media is really restricted there, really restricted. You can't access things like Al Jazeera. You can't access loads of international channels. It's really restricted.
I don't know that. I take your word for it until somebody confirms
or challenges. There are ways around it if you want to know.
And also, some of the media there, like Haaretz, has been incredibly critical of Benjamin Netanyahu for years. So...
So if you want to see change, what can be done? The fundamental change is Israel itself. It's its people. There has to be.
Everyone is offering up, and I mean this, I say this with gratitude and thanks, but it's as if the actual question we've already kind of rolled over on. What can we do to stop Netanyahu's plan? And when I say we, I mean all the people asking him to stop, from the United Nations to the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. It's as if that question is already withered on the vine, and the question that everyone's answering instead is either what can other people do, in this case the Israelis, or what can we do to minimize the impact of what he's going to do anyway? A sense, is this fair in your case, Farah? A sense that it's already game over on the Gaza, the attempted occupation of Gaza?
I think he will occupy Gaza, but
yeah,
Gaza will. I don't think they're going to live in slavery for the rest of their existence. Human beings rise up and they fight for their freedoms and they fight for the right to life. You know, they do that. You can just look it through history all the way through. My concern
they don't
is
always
whether
there
will be any Palestinians. No, they don't. But if you look at the Palestinians, they have been living under this occupation for the best part of 100 years. Well, no, not the occupation, but this sort of fight for the best part of 100 years. They are incredibly resilient. I cannot believe the children, the videos from the children that I listen to. They literally have come out of rubble. They are saying that they are not going to leave their land. I do think eventually they will have their own state, but my concern is how many more people are going to suffer and how much longer are we as a planet, as a global community, going to become almost immune to this? Like, this is normal. Like, you know, one of the worst things about this is that this slaughter, this genocide has become normalized.
That's,
you know,
yeah, the phrase discussing matter-of-factly, the kind of death tolls that we're discussing and the behaviors that we're discussing, the starvation that we're discussing, the revulsion that should go hand in hand with much of this. It does seem to diminish with every passing week or every passing month because you get used to it. That's often the way. I saw the picture of the Israeli hostage in a state of extraordinary, unbearable emaciation, and you almost feel relieved that you're still horrified by some of the things that are coming out. The pictures of the starving children, the picture of the starving hostage. You recognise, well, I haven't become normalised to that. But the news about another 30 people that have been shot dead trying to get food, you probably are getting normalised to that. What's the next thing we get normalised to? And do you agree with the caller so far, either expressed or unexpressed sense, that there's no point trying to stop Netanyahu from occupying the whole of Gaza? The questions we should be asking are about what we can do to minimise the impact, or in the absence of any meaningful leverage on the part of the West or the world, apart from the United States, who could possibly bring anything to bear? Because I don't think it's going to happen domestically anytime soon, despite all the protests. And I understand why. And it's an important element of the conversation that I can't repeat too often. There is nothing difficult about understanding why many people in Israel feel that there is nothing that cannot be contemplated or done in defence of the safety of Israel. You don't need a PhD in history to understand why Jewish people feel that the defence of the place they go to when it starts happening again overrides all concerns, whether they are international law concerns or reputational concerns or diplomatic concerns or even matters of life and death. There is no price too high to pay to protect this land as the place we go to when it all starts happening again, as you know, history has taught them and us it will. But that doesn't excuse, it simply explains. And if you don't acknowledge that, then you don't make any progress whatsoever in understanding what is happening and what is likely to happen next. Thomas Watts is here with your headlines.
The British government has condemned plans by Israel to escalate its offensive in Gaza. Sir Keir Starmer's warned the move to occupy Gaza City will only bring more bloodshed and won't help secure the release of Israeli hostages. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, will discuss Gaza and Ukraine with J.D. Vance today. Mr. Lammy is hosting the U.S. Vice President at Chevening, his official country house in Kent, during Mr. Vance's holiday in the U.K. A four-year-old boy has died after he was hit by a bus outside a hospital in Kent. It happened outside the Queen Elizabeth the Queen Mother Hospital in Margate yesterday afternoon. LBC weather. Most of the UK dry with sunny spells. Some rain in northern Scotland. A high of 26 degrees.
This is LBC.
So, where are we going?
You wanted to try something new? Well, we're here.
The Hyundai electrifying summer event.
I booked a test drive in the all-new Insta online. It's the 2025 World Electric Vehicle winner, and we save £500 if we order before the 31st of August.
Ooh, very stylish.
Oh, and it's Hyundai, by the way.
The Hyundai electrifying summer event. Are you in? 18 plus UK retail customers only. Excludes Motability. Registered by 30th of September. T's and C's apply.
Pump six in this meal deal, please.
Let's play Rate My BP Meal Deal.
Okay.
You chose an M&S chicken and bacon pasta, Magnum ice cream and a Wild Bean Cafe iced latte. That's a 10. A perfect warm weather combo.
Ever won a holiday?
No. BP Meal Deal. One deal, millions of combinations. All for £6.
T's and C's apply, subject to availability at BP M&S stores only. For details, see bp.com/latest offers.
The new single drops. The world tour begins. As artists create the music we love, you could be right there in the mix. Calling all young creatives. If you want a career in music, then listen up. Global Academy have a new 6-4 music production course. State-of-the-art studios, practical experience, hands-on learning with music professionals. Awesome! Apply now at globalacademy.com.
With UK Export Finance, I'm fulfilling more export orders from around the world with working capital support.
Export insurance means I'll get paid when exporting to challenging markets.
At UK Export Finance, we believe no viable UK export should fail for lack of finance or insurance. Between 2023 and 2024, we provided £8.8 billion of government-backed trade finance to support UK exports. Learn how we could help you win export contracts, fulfil orders and get paid. Search UK Export Finance today.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60 973.
33 minutes after 11, and just a little more on why there is no point expecting or hoping for the United States of America to intervene in staying Benjamin Netanyahu's hand over his plans to occupy the whole of Gaza. I wonder if you can guess who said this in 2017 to a group of reporters. There are certain words I refuse to use. There is no such thing as a West Bank. It's Judea and Samaria. There's no such thing as a settlement. They're communities, they're neighbourhoods, they're cities. There's no such thing as an occupation. I'll give you a clue. It's the same bloke who said yesterday, it's not our job to tell them, as in Israel, what they should or should not do. And that is Mike Huckabee, the envoy, who is what is known as a Christian Zionist, a kind of a depiction or a description that is not black and white. Lots of people who would describe themselves thus disagree about some elements of what they believe, but it's essentially a belief that that God gave Israel to Jewish people, and Jewish people must be in control of that land before the second coming of Christ can occur. And listen, if you're rolling your eyes at this, this is a really huge political, not just religious movement in the United States of America, of which Mike Huckabee and the Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, are fully paid up members. I don't know if they're fully paid up to the final bit, which is that when the judgment day comes, which can only come if Jewish people are in control of these lands, the Holy Land, then there will be a sort of final reckoning under which all Jewish people will either be killed or have to convert to Christianity. So your average Christian Zionist isn't necessarily a friend of the Jewish people, but you could probably take your chances on the second coming of Christ never happening. I don't know. It depends how lucky you're feeling as you spin that particular roulette wheel. But that is Huckabee speaking a few years ago. Hegseth, similarly, there's an archived recording of Hegseth. You can find all of this on National Public Radio, their website. A journalist called Jason DeRose undertook the research into this and found the relevant clips. Hegseth saying there's no reason why the miracle of the re-establishment of the temple on the Temple Mount is not possible. And that, of course, would involve removing a mosque, one of the most sacred places of worship in the Muslim religion, and, damn the consequences. He's also got tattoos, if you're interested in some in these things, that echo symbols of the medieval Christian crusades. So there you go. That is what you're up against if you're thinking that there's going to be some sort of intervention from Mike Huckabee or indeed Donald Trump, because there ain't. Steve's in Burgess Hill. Steve, what would you like to say?
Good morning, James. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Just picking up on the point that your previous caller said about using the mechanisms of the UN and the resolutions that are able to be passed. I mean, we do have a historical precedence with this that we can use today. And domestically, nothing's going to enforce Israel to do anything, so it has to be done internationally as a response. So, you know, if we look back into the Bosnian genocide, the siege of Sarajevo, in particular, where starvation was used as a tactic to try and enact what the Serbs and the Bosnian Serbs wanted, the UN did create protected safe zones, and that's when the international community stepped up using NATO airstrikes. You know, a little bit later on, but they stepped up by implementing a force that would go there, and they would become the buffer between the Bosnian Serbs who were attacking the Bosnian civilians, who were the Bosniaks who were the enemy at the time, in order just to protect them and to get the food stocks into Sarajevo and then defend other areas. I mean, there was a notable lapse where it failed, obviously, in 1995 in Srebrenica, where the genocide took place. But that was an overall mission that was there to largely internationally based, but to protect people who had no ability to defend themselves.
Were you
against
there?
Overwhelming aggression.
Did you say you were there?
Yes, I was. Yeah, in 1995. Yeah, we were. I was part of the surge forces that went in. I mean, it's spread from.
How feasible is this though with an ally like Israel? How feasible would that be? I don't know what the diplomatic channels would look like or what the law would allow, but it feels very, that's why I wanted to establish that you were there, because you're a lot more qualified than I am to draw parallels between something you've witnessed than I am. But it seems a bit of a stretch to think that we could do, they could do, anyone could do that in this context.
It's very much a stretch. But I mean, the current options on the table are almost none. So either we do something or we do nothing. It's a dichotomy of that at the moment. And to do nothing, it just bears ill will for the future, for the rest of humanity at a great scale. We have the ability to do something. If we can't do it diplomatically through our normal channels, then we have to use the stick approach. And I mean, the stick approach does not have to be military intervention immediately. I'm talking about hard power military intervention with airstrikes and things like that. But that is an option that is
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it, to think that Starmer's language now has become fairly robust, and the horrors of not backing up strong language with strong actions are now very close to the horizon, aren't they?
Very close to the horizon. And the proof is in the example that I've given. The siege of Sarajevo was only broken when the airstrikes and artillery bombardment took place on the Bosnian Serb targets around there. And then that then brought them to negotiating table, and then they withdrew to...
But I don't think anyone was talking then about airlifting all the Bosniaks to Somaliland or dropping them all off in the middle of Morocco or anything is another evidence of how different this situation potentially is.
Yeah, and the numbers by comparison were measurably smaller. If I remember rightly, that like the population of Sarajevo was like something in the region of 500,000 people or less. So, but we're talking, you know, almost five times that amount, you know, just in Gaza alone. Mm. So yeah, arguably the gravity is much greater now than what it was back then in the mid to early 90s. Yet we were able to muster enough
to do something.
To do something.
I hear you. I mean, it is again. I know I keep reaching for it, but it is yet more proof of just how complete the vacuum is at the moment in terms of what a more meaningful response than diplomatic or verbal objections would look like. Wallach, I hope I pronounced that correctly. I've started reading quite a lot of his work. He's a reader in Israeli studies and head of the Center for Jewish Studies at SOAS. He grew up in Israel. His family still resides there. He's written a piece calling for proper sanctions. He wrote a couple, from the banking system to defense, cooperation from trade to tourism and academia, the UK is connected to Israel in myriad ways. By continuing business as usual, Israel's international partners are allowing the Israeli government to continue with its genocidal campaign with no consequences beyond symbolic gestures of disapproval and statements. I think they're more than symbolic, but I don't know that I could win that argument with Yair Wallach. For many of us, this is a deeply painful moment, calling on our government to sanction the state where we grew up, to which we are closely attached and where our families and friends live, is not an easy step. But we are horrified, not only by what has happened, but also by what is likely to happen if we do not take such steps. And that was published towards the end of last month, on the 29th of July, even before Benjamin Netanyahu's determination to occupy the whole of Gaza was formalized. You can read that. I'll share it with you actually on my Blue Sky account. But if you've just tuned in, I should stress again that the author is the head of the Center for Jewish Studies at SOAS, part of the University of London, and a reader in Israeli studies who grew up in Israel and whose family still reside there. And I've been sent that article, reminded of that article, as I did read it at the time, by somebody else who grew up in Israel and still has family there, who's been a wonderful counsel to me throughout all of this issue, and a slightly troubling reminder that you don't really get the full picture anywhere in the UK media. You really have to cast your net far and wide in order to find perspectives and inputs that are important and helpful, none of which helps us answer the question of what on earth can actually be done. Adam is in Lewisham. Adam, what would you like to say?
Hi, James.
Hello, mate.
Thanks for taking the call. So some of your callers have touched on this already, but so there's two things which I would also echo and back up. Both have been mentioned by, or called for by Francesco Albanese at the Hague Group conference in Bogota, which was shortly after she spoke with you. The first being sanctions, total sanctions, meaning economic, diplomatic, academic.
Which is, I think, what Wolak is calling for. And I'm only pausing you to make a point that I think is important. This is a position that becomes plausible today. With today's, I know that was calling for it earlier, and many people have called for sanctions earlier. I just want to make it clear that this is a response to the question of what can be done to stop Benjamin Netanyahu from occupying the whole of Gaza. It may have been an answer. It may even have been your answer to a question that was posed months or even years ago. But for the purposes of this program, that is what we're looking at. This very specific plan that is opposed by almost everybody. How could we get him to stop?
And and there were two calls. So one was the sanctions, and she also called upon all countries that have Mediterranean ports to start sending boats to break the siege. A caller mentioned earlier, Greta Thunberg. This needs to be done on an industrial scale, and the siege needs to be broken. Other than that, I don't think there's any other way to stop them. They will not be stopped because there is no cost to them for continuing.
Crikey, you've managed to distill that down into a sentence. There is no cost to continuing.
And also, you mentioned the word ally quite a few times.
Keir Starmer's disapproval, Adam.
you've mentioned the word ally quite a few times.
Yes,
so why are countries allies with each other? So, I would say probably two things. They have shared interests and common values.
Yes.
I don't know what the current shared interests are in continuing this, but the common values, let's say, the common values might be upholding international law and the rules-based order. Now, the problem with that is that what I've come to realise is that actually international law and upholding the rules-based order are not the same thing. They're actually opposed to each other.
Go on.
Well, international law, you have the ICJ, which has recently said that it's ruled that the occupation is illegal, that the occupation must be...
Oh, I see. Yes, sorry, what you mean. This is in the rearview mirror rather than the road ahead, but the rearview mirror defines what may well be ahead.
Yes, I mean, talking about allies, yes. So,
yes, of course.
The occupation must be stopped. It must be stopped unconditionally. They must retreat. They must pay reparations. Now, I'm not under any illusion that's going to happen anytime soon. But if we were to sort of stand by what we say as a UK, what we say are our beliefs, that we want to uphold international law, that's what we would be doing. But actually, our allegiance seems to be upholding the international rules-based order, which is might is right, and we can do whatever we want.
And that is very much what defines Donald Trump, who is the only person probably who could make a meaningful intervention in this space. I don't want to ask you this question, really, but I'm going to, because I'm really interested in your answer. Do you think it's going to happen? Do you think the full occupation, the control of Gaza City, the yet another displacement of hundreds of thousands of people?
If we let it, it absolutely will.
That's not an answer. I'm not being aggressive. I mean, obviously, if we let it, it absolutely will. But do you think we are going to let it?
It looks that way to me, sadly. It's a shame.
Gosh. I'm going to cling to the hope that it doesn't or that it isn't, but it's an increasingly forlorn hope. Thank you, Adam. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. The time is 11:47.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC. She's the only fan star that's got everybody talking.
She's making a living out of disgusting men.
It's just completely sick, and she's deluded herself into thinking it's a good idea.
Now it's time to hear from the woman who gained international notoriety after sleeping with 1,000 men in a day.
I'm just a girl, I'm relatable, I'm sort of the girl next door vibes, and I want people to be able to watch my videos and be able to imagine themselves in it.
Bonnie Blue joins me, Tom Swarbrick, for a tell-all interview. Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on your radio, on Global Player, and the new LBC app.
With Little Plus Bakery Spin, simply shop and spin to win a free Little Bakery coupon on every shop. Download Little Plus and get a little bit more at the Retail Industry Awards Supermarket of the Year.
18 plus GB residents, various prizes available, subject to availability, ends 20th of August. Full T's and C's apply. See little.co.uk/spin.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family, get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, top up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure when tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with TRIP.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
Train to Peckham. Kids in tow. Rooftop cinema time.
6 packs of popcorn. I think one will do, Nina.
Ah, clear skies, comfy seats, a talking panda, clearly what we all needed. Okay, everyone's seated now, happily doing panda impressions. I wonder when Nan can watch the kids so I can come back with James. Oh, just the two of us.
Download the Southern Railway app to book advance tickets from only £8 on off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply, see our website for full details.
Who's a good human? Alex is. Because today's dog walk with Lulu the Corgi has turned into an off-grid adventure. But wherever Lulu's nose takes her, Alex will always gladly follow. That's why he also chooses Butternut Box for Lulu's meals. Freshly prepared and served straight from the fridge, helping Lulu thrive from nose to tail. Meaning one less trek for Alex, as we deliver each box straight to your door. Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
Huh. Have you ever wondered what a sandwich sounds like? Not much to it, is there? Unless, of course, it's a Walker's sandwich. Mmm, that is good. Now that's what a sarnie should sound like. Go all crispin' with Walker's. Delicious.
Serious about the right vitamins for you and your family? Trust Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company, for expert nutritional care for every age and lifestyle. Vitamins for everyone, including well man, well woman, well baby, and well kid. From Boots, pharmacies, and Vitabiotics.com. For number one verification, see Vitabiotics.com.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
10 to 12 is the time. A complete change of pace now, because Kidderminster Harriers kick off their new football season tomorrow against Scarborough Town, but it is to another seaside town, another English seaside town that I want to turn your attention next through the lens of football, because, well, there are two reasons. There are two headlines. The first is this one, totally torn apart, how Morecambe's decline threatens a whole community. And that is the possibility of a football club ceasing to exist, and the impact that it has on an entire town, not just on the followers or the supporters or the fans of the club itself. But the other one is a headline from last month that I'd never got around to talking to you about. It was about GPs in one area to prescribe football matches as an alternative to antidepressants. This is a GP's practice in Gloucestershire that is piloting, well, 11 practices indeed across Stroud, piloting a scheme known as social prescribing. And it essentially tells people with mild or moderate depression that some experiences can have a beneficial effect upon their actual equilibrium, their mood, their mental equilibrium, up to and including mild and low level depression. And I couldn't help seeing, because I keep a little folder of stories, and they actually came out next to each other. And I mean a paper folder. I'm very analog. It drives everybody mad. But I cut things out of the newspapers. And these two stories, one from the BBC's website and one from Pulse, the sort of doctor's trade journal, they actually came out of my folder yesterday on top of each other. Headline one, GPs in one area to prescribe football matches as antidepressant alternative. Headline two, totally torn apart, how Morecambe's decline threatens a whole community. And I thought we'd take a moment this morning to find out a little bit more about what is going on in Morecambe. Sheffield Wednesday fans were probably wondering why we're not talking about them. But the reason is Morecambe came out on top. And Rod Taylor is a former co-chairman of Morecambe Football Club, who should, I think, would your season be starting tomorrow, Rod, in the National League as well, as Kidderminster's in the National League North?
Yeah, good morning, Jay. Yes, it certainly would. We will be playing Boston United tomorrow. That's where we should be.
But will you be?
No, absolutely not. No, our first three games have been postponed due to the ongoing ownership crisis. We're under a transfer embargo, and was suspended from the league until the 20th of this month, when that decision will be looked at again. But unless we get the ownership situation sorted out, I fear for the future of the football club.
What's happened? How has the club ended up in this situation?
Well, the club's been for sale for 2.5 years. The owners, Bond Group Investments Limited, the only director there is Jason Whittingham. They've owned the club for a number of years now. He's wanted to sell. That sale hasn't got over the line for a number of reasons with various suitors. And for the past, over the past year, a consortium called Punjab Warriors have been the latest prospective owners. And for whatever reason, Mr. Whittingham will not drive this deal over the line. Punjab Warriors passed all the EFL owners and directors tests. They proved source and sufficiency of their funds. And at the 11th hour, Mr. Whittingham said that he wasn't in a position to conclude the deal because of other things in the background, whether that's ownership of the shares more likely, he needs to get some permission from his investors. It remains to be seen.
And he is, I mean, obviously we've contacted him for comment, but he's not really talking to anybody at the moment, which is, as you describe it, part of the problem. Rod, bearing in mind that not everybody who's listening to you at the moment is a fellow fan of a non-league football club, give us an idea, and I sense pessimism in your voice. I don't sense much hope that the light at the end of the tunnel is likely to get much brighter. What does it do to a town like Morecambe? What would it do to a town like Morecambe if the football club were to go under, were to disappear?
Yeah, James, I am still optimistic.
Oh, good.
We were a football league club for the last 18 years. We came up through, you know, the Northern Premier League, the Vauxhall Conference, into the Football League, into League One.
Yeah.
For a couple of years. And the lack of investment since then has really put us on our knees. The impact on the town, I feel, is enormous, you know, from the point of view of the local economy, visiting teams and fans coming into the town on a Saturday or Tuesday evening. Generation of families. I mean, my grandfather took me to Christie Park, the old ground, when I was about 5 or 6 years of age. That's what got me on the hook of Morecambe Football Club, and of football, by the way.
Yeah.
And that runs through your family. My kids were brought up round the ground, and now grandchildren. And I feel for, and it's, by the way, I'm trying to put a personal slant on that, but I don't mean that in the way it's all about this.
Of course you don't.
Generations of families all around this locality are the same, and it's heartbreaking to see them.
And Morecambe is one of those holiday destinations. I visited it myself as a boy on a number of occasions. In fact, I should tell you this because everybody listening's heard the story about 1,000 times. I went to quite a posh school, and when I came back after the summer holidays and all my mates had been to places like Barbados, my dad told me to tell everyone I'd been to Morecambe for my holidays because it sounded more exotic than Morecambe. So I do know the town, but I don't know what, I mean, impact it's going to have economically. It had zoos, it had fairgrounds. It's still a lovely place to go for a holiday, but it's going to have even less if this particular problem isn't sorted out.
Yeah, I think the town itself seriously is on the up. There's a lot of things going on, such as the Eden Morecambe project, which is looking increasingly likely to happen. I'm confident it will happen, which will have a seismic influence on the not just the town, but the whole of North Lancashire, I feel. From a football perspective, and it's not just, James, it's not just about football. Football is the focus of it. But for instance, we've got a football academy, that could fall apart very easily. We have the community trust that does all sorts of initiatives in the locality, from schools and after school clubs to care homes, to military veterans, to prehab cancer clinics, local festivals, on girls football, on and on it goes. And that community initiative touches many, many people way beyond the actual match day experience those people wouldn't normally come into contact with.
That's beautifully put. And on a, I mean, just a serious note, there'll be a couple of pubs, I presume, that will go under if they don't get the fortnightly traffic across the bar, or at least they'll have a very significant change to their fortunes if they don't get the home game business every 2 weeks during the season.
It's a very good point, because look, the tourist economy is basically summertime, spring and summertime, isn't it? So football's played throughout the darker months, and that influx of supporters from the opposition clubs is really meaningful to local economy, local businesses, restaurants, pubs, whatever, hotels.
Rod, I hope it works out. In fact, I'll tell you what I really hope. I hope you get back in business by next month. You stay in the National League. Kidderminster get promoted from the National League North, and I'll come and see you when we play in Morecambe next season.
Well, our first away game in the conference was at Kidderminster Harriers. First away game, yeah.
Did you have a pie?
No, the pies are better at Morecambe, James.
Getting serious.
But we were one up in the first few minutes, and we thought this league we're gonna you know hammer Bought this it. League, and we ended up losing about 4-1, I think it was.
Happy days, Rod. Thank you, and take care, Rod Taylor, former co-chairman of Morecambe FC, describing a very English malaise, or very British malaise, the way in which the decline of a football club, or the neglect of a football club perhaps, can have impacts far beyond the confines of the stadium. We have attempted to contact Jason Whittingham, the owner, via both Morecambe Football Club and Bond Group Investments Limited, but we have not been able to reach him. The club say he has not been responding to journalists' requests. The time now is 12 noon. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Up next, one of the most persecuted and misunderstood sections of our society have been defended, championed no less, by one of my favourite actors. Who are we talking about?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, Germany has halted military exports to Israel in response to a planned expansion of the offensive in Gaza. Israel's war cabinet met last night to approve plans to take control of Gaza City, which could be the first phase of a wider takeover. Sir Keir Starmer has warned the operation will only bring more bloodshed. The energy minister, Miatta van Bulley, has told LBC it is the wrong move.
We are urging the Israeli government to reconsider that decision. And why are we saying that? Is because we think that this will be an escalation at a time that we have got an absolutely horrendous situation on the ground in Gaza.
The Foreign Secretary David Lammy is due to hold talks with the US Vice President J.D. Vance. They are expected to discuss Gaza and Ukraine at evening. Mr. Lammy's official country residence in Kent. A 4-year-old boy has died after being hit by a bus outside a hospital in Kent. Police were called to the Queen Elizabeth Queen Mother in Margate yesterday. LBC's Letty Buxton has more.
The 4-year-old boy was hit by a white single-decker bus which was travelling near the entrance to the A&D department. He was taken back inside the hospital, where he was pronounced dead soon after. Kent police are urging anyone with relevant information to come forward.
The head of West Midlands Police has told LBC that officers are always striving to be transparent. Chief Constable Craig Guildford has backed his neighbouring force in Warwickshire over the handling of a rape case in Nuneaton. There were claims of a cover-up over the two suspects' backgrounds. Mr Guildford says forces have to operate within the bounds of the law as it is.
At the moment, the rules are under review. And they're under review by the CPS, the National Police Chiefs Council, and also there's a Law Commission review ongoing. And I think what we need to do is wait and see what comes out of there and then act accordingly and act properly. But in terms of the broader theme of transparency, absolutely. We produce loads of data, and of course we want to give as much information as possible.
A heat health alert will come into force across parts of England on Monday afternoon. It will cover Yorkshire and the Humber, the East Midlands, as well as the East, South East and South West of England. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 91.04. That's up 3. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.50. LBC weather, most of the UK dry with sunny spells this afternoon, some rain in northern Scotland. A high of 26 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC,
I'm Thomas Watts.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T. Drop up on island fuel. R. Rest every 2 hours too. I. Inspect tire pressure and tread. P. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with TRIP.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It is 3 minutes after 10. You are listening. 12. 3 minutes after 12. Stop it. 12. Not 10. 3 minutes after 12. Everyone relax, all right? Seriously, I'm not going there again. It is 3 minutes after 12, and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where we are poised to have a conversation that might look like a light-hearted one. And I think at one point in my life, I would have treated it as a light-hearted story, but I don't actually think that it is. I have this thing. I've also got an unhinged headline for you this hour. I've got a real treat of a full disclosure. And the answer to the question that everybody has already worked out for themselves, which is why have I been looking at a map of Norfolk this morning with particular reference to where Great Yarmouth sits in relation to the North Sea? I shall share details of that story with you, hopefully a little later this hour, just in case you've been living under a rock and haven't seen it already. But I want to turn your attention next, if I may. Well, of course I may. I'm blooming well going to. What a ludicrous turn of phrase that is. To something that Tony Robinson, another former guest. God, is there going to come a day when we can't mention anybody we like on this programme without adding that they've appeared on Full Disclosure? I think, no, Keith, you're never going to be on Full Disclosure, and we're not even sure that we... No. We look at a story that Tony Robinson has brought to attention. It's been propelled quite far into public discourse. And it is done in a way that lends itself to a little bit of levity, a little bit of lightheartedness, as in not taking his complaints seriously. And I've got a fairly strong feeling that I have failed to take his complaint seriously in the past. I think that you come to people who are men, in particular, who are well below average height, and you find yourself leaning into a little bit of mickey-taking or a little bit of mockery. And you do so with a largely clean conscience. So I very occasionally, because I'm pretty woke, but I'm not as woke as some, I very occasionally get reminded by my daughters, who are obviously much younger than me, that... I'll say something, and that's, I'll just see from their faces that they think that what I've said is a little bit, well, certainly not funny, and worse than a dad joke, it's a little bit, and so, for example, I may have made a joke or made a comment about someone's height, and my daughters will sort of roll their eyes, and I catch myself occasionally, not for a while now, because I think I've probably learnt more from them than they've learnt from me over the last few years, not least how amazing Lola Young is, just for music fans. And I would catch myself saying, or I would in the past catch myself saying, God, you're not allowed to take the mickey out of anybody anymore, are you? I would not add at that point, it's political correctness gone mad. But it's a similar impulse to people who used to be whining all the time. It's political correctness gone mad. And then, because I am so woke and so fond of doing the work, as therapists say, I found myself thinking, why do you want to take the mickey out of anyone, mate? I'm perfectly capable of living in an incredibly lovely, funny, happy world without actually mocking people. I'm not ready. Mocking individuals is very different. Let me make that absolutely clear. I'm probably not even going to win this argument with some people, but I don't know that I could do my job if I had persuaded myself that I should stop taking the mickey out of specific individuals For example, you know, hard man of Brexit, Steve Baker, and countless other characters who have contributed to public discourse. In fact, we've got an unhinged headline coming up a little bit later with one of the daftest of them all, inevitably writing in the comment pages of the Daily Telegraph. I think it's a qualification now that you have to be truly unhinged in order to get commissioned to write a comment piece in the Daily Telegraph. No prizes for guessing who it is who qualifies as the... Oh, you can't say the daftest of them all, because there'd be a fight. You'd have Daniel Hannan saying, "No, I am the daftest of them all." And then you'd have Alistair Heath coming forward, "So I am the daftest of them all. I'm the one that said Liz Truss was a genius." And Hannan would say, "Well, I said Brexit would make us all richer." And they'd sort of take it in turns about who is the most unhinged of them all. But today's contender is definitely up there. He's definitely a top 10 player. And I do think now, why would you take the mickey out of everybody who's got ginger hair, or everybody who's obese, or everybody who is wearing glasses, or everybody who is short? I'm not yet ready to embrace the world in which nobody ever mocks anybody, because you wouldn't be allowed to mock me in that world. And how on earth would you get through the day if you weren't allowed to mock me? And I also quite like to mock myself in a variety of ways. But why do you want to mock anybody for something over which they have no control? For the way that they look? For the way that they speak? I don't know. I sort of find it hard not to take the mickey out of Jacob Rees-Mogg for speaking in such an obviously confected and inauthentic way. But that is also something over which he has control, isn't it? Tony Robinson has said on the rather splendid How to Fail podcast with the rather splendid Elizabeth Day, "Nowadays you don't pick on people's looks, do you? It's like kind of a new understanding over the last 10 or 15 years. You don't deride people for what they look like." And yet, as he points out, you do still deride people for how tall they are. It's one of the last bastions, if you like, of acceptable abuse. Robinson, the star of Blackadder, in case you don't remember, Baldric in Blackadder, brilliant actor, particularly cross with women who feel it's acceptable to comment on men's lack of height on dating apps and things like that. And yet, for our purposes, I think we will extend it further, because he goes exactly where we've gone. He says you had the fat acceptance movement. And while there are still issues, you'd never go, "Well, how much do you weigh?" or "You're fat, aren't you?" But it's perfectly acceptable for people to go, "How tall are you?" And I have not taken this subject seriously in the past, and I'd like to take it seriously today, because I caught myself doing it yesterday. I can't remember the exact figure, all right, but someone put on Blue Sky, "Robert Jenrick is 5'5". And I found myself going, "Ah, oh, of course he is." I don't know what that means, really, except that I sometimes associate fairly extreme right-wing views with a level of personal unhappiness that can only be explained by uncontrollable attributes. But that, what a horrible impulse that was. I know loads of people who aren't particularly tall who are utterly lovely, and yet we all fall into the trap of pointing out that Napoleon and Hitler and various other fascists were all tiny. So that's part of the problem here. But on a less serious note, the idea that it is acceptable. And the thing is, I think maybe hair is one of the only other things that's left. If you're losing your hair, people feel that they're perfectly entitled to comment on it. If you had a massive boil on the end of your nose, or if you had a growth coming out the side of your neck, and you were meeting someone, an acquaintance, I don't mean like your mum or your best friend, for whom nothing is off limits, but nobody would ever say, "Gosh, that's a very unpleasant spot you've got on the end of your nose." Nobody would ever say, "Gosh, you're very fat, aren't you?" Nobody would ever say, I don't think you'd even point out bad breath, which is something over which you can exercise control. So let us call it it's not even undesirable. I don't even know what it is. An attribute. Let's call it a mockable attribute. Almost all of them now are off limits. You know, you would not really comment on any aspect of somebody's physical appearance except their height. You know, what's it like down there? Or the opposite, what's it like up there? I know that people like Richard Osman find it incredibly boring when we take it upon ourselves to crack a height joke that he's only ever heard 1,007,000 times before. So it's really odd. I'm more interested in the first instance about people who are well below average height, but I suspect the experience is a bit similar for people who are well above average height, but without that evolutionary angle, in that taller partners are desirable. And what Tony Robinson is talking about is women making it absolutely clear that shorter partners are not. It's a thing, by the way, the Napoleon complex, before you get cross with me. It's the theory that short men may compensate with antagonistic behaviours. And I actually now find myself wondering what it's like to be not only the victim or recipient of looks-based discrimination, looks-based mockery, but also to know that if you were to complain about it, as Tony Robinson has done, then many people, most people, maybe all people, would not take you seriously. We've done it with Marc Francois, haven't we? I don't know that I've ever gone in particularly hard on his height, but I've certainly laughed at pictures of him that have probably been doctored to make him look even smaller than he actually is in the company of much taller men. And that's really not very nice. It's really not very nice. So I actually want to know I don't want you to be shy. I want to create a space, if I can this hour, where you can actually get it off your chest. And in a way that doesn't invite other people to, oh, get over yourself. It's not as if no one's going to be setting fire to hotels full of short people anytime soon. It doesn't matter, does it, that other people endure more than you endure when it comes to abuse or discrimination for the way that you look. And also don't, for this conversation at least, let's not bring racism into it, except to reflect that until relatively recently, you weren't allowed to be racist in this country without inviting high levels of quite correct disapproval. Unfortunately, now you can write columns for national newspapers, present television and radio programs, and even get elected into parliament for being pretty much just and only exclusively for being a racist. But that is a sad and relatively recent reversal of where we were before. Gingers have to put up with it. Ginger people have to put up with it. And I come from a ginger family, so I can say that without any fear or favour. But I want to talk about shortness. And I want to talk about men. And in other words, I want to talk about short men and what you have to put up with. Okay? 0345 6060 973. I reckon a lot of people will be nodding along with what Tony Robinson has said, but you will also be conscious of not really ever having voiced these concerns publicly because people wouldn't take you seriously. I really want to take you seriously today, okay? 0345 6060 973 is the number to call. And you see, the thing is another interesting thing. If I now said, and on the other hand, should you just get over it? Could you imagine if I ever said that about, well, maybe I would have done once, about obesity or about other physical characteristics for which you get abused? And I said, oh, who cares that you're getting abused? You should just get over it. I don't think you would do that anymore. That's the question. Heightism is a term that was only coined in 1971 by a lecturer in sociology and disability studies at Liverpool. There is a lecturer in sociology and disability studies at Liverpool University explaining that they believe heightism is subconscious, but also that it is ingrained. It's never had a widespread acceptance movement. You've never had a movement saying, please stop fat shaming. There's no such thing as short shaming. Do you see what I mean? Hey, that's good. That's not in the article. I just came up with that myself. So we all know what fat shaming is. You've really got to stop doing this. You've really got to stop fat-shaming people. I used to fat-shame people on this programme. It's one of my most embarrassing memories of presenting this show. No one's ever done short-shaming. No one's ever said, can you please stop shaming short people? And I genuinely, reading this article, I genuinely don't think that's fair. And I'm guilty of it, because even yesterday, in the context of Napoleon complexes, I read about Robert Jenrick being particularly short. He may not even be short. I may be, well, I'm not doing him a disservice. I may be misrepresenting his height. But that's what someone posted on Blue Sky, and I read it and thought, oh, of course he is. Of course he's short. That explains why he's so angry and so determined to hurt other people, like, you know, children looking at murals. But that's a really grim response, even if Napoleon complex is a real thing. I don't know if I'm going to throw open the floor to very tall people, because I don't think your plight is the same. I think it's very different. I think that the sex element of this is key. Tony Robinson is talking about dating apps, among other things, and women who expressly say on their profile, I don't want a short man. That's really quite hard to imagine from the point of view of not being short. Why on earth would you... Why wouldn't you want to... I'm really nice. I'm really good looking. But I'm 5'6". So you really, you're not even going to give me the time of day? You're not even going to give me a chance to woo you or to show you how lovely I am? You're literally saying you're short, you're off the list? I mean, you can imagine people doing that on the grounds of ethnicity, perhaps, or... even hair colour, but I don't think it would necessarily be acceptable to stick it on your dating profile. Well, I know that it wouldn't. I know that it wouldn't. Pete says, I love you, James, but stop waffling and get on with it. Mate, it's Friday and it's been a long week. If I want to have a little waffle, particularly after 2 hours in the incredibly tricky territory of matters Middle East and matters Israel and Gaza, then I jolly well will. But I do, on the other hand, take your point. Hit the numbers now, you will get through. That the idea that mocking short men, discriminating against short men, abusing even short men, is one of the last acceptable acts of offensiveness. And the crucial point here, that it really shouldn't be. So what has happened to you, and how do you feel about the fact that people are allowed, in quotes, to take the mickey out of your physical characteristic in ways that society has concluded other physical characteristics are not fair game for mockery? 0345 6060 973.
This is LBC.
The best bit of sailing from Dover to Calais has to be the Irish Ferries bit. Irish Ferries. See travel differently.
The Seagull says, your IKEA food favourites are now available in Brighton. Meatballs, plant balls, fish and chips. All delicious. Especially the chips. Yum. IKEA Brighton. Open 14th of August. IKEA, the wonderful everyday.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ADVICE to 78900 to find out more. That's ADVICE to 78900.
When you go abroad, everyone knows the best way to make yourself understood is to say everything in English, but louder.
Four beers, please, garçon!
Just like when you amplify your advertising with radio. 40 million listeners every week get the message. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Hodge, who do you think you're listening to? Hodge's been in touch to say, you almost wrapped it up for the break then, James, but then you carried on speaking. Hello, this is the James O'Brien program. Of course I did. It's what I do. I don't let me forget the unhinged headline. I certainly won't forget the full disclosure this week, and the Great Yarmouth story as well. But before all of that, not the only acceptable physical attribute that other people feel that they're entitled to mock or comment on, but more mock than comment on. So I think if you're very slim, people might comment on that, but I don't think they're going to mock you. Maybe they are, but if you're short, particularly if you're a man, you seem to have somehow missed progress, don't you? Missed the recent moves towards being a little bit more kind and being a little bit more considerate about other people's feelings. I just wonder what it's like. Dave's in Bristol. Dave, what would you like to say?
Oh, hi, James. Hello, thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, I had a bit of an incident in a wellbeing course, funny enough, this week within work. And person running the wellbeing course...
Shall I apologize? No, we didn't. I had to drop that last word that you used. So what we're going to say, Dave, is took the mickey. I don't think you need to be Columbo to work out what Dave said there that you didn't hear, but we're going to go with the person running the well-being course at your work took the mickey out of you over
That's
what?
Correct, sorry.
That's all right, mate. Don't worry.
Yeah. So they took the mick, basically. I basically suggested sort of standing desks. It would be good to rather than sort of like being slumbered and sat on a chair all day. She pointed at a low-rise desk and said, "Oh, there's your standing desk there," which raised a few giggles around the
room. Because it wasn't a standing desk at all, and because
that's
you are quite short.
Yeah.
That's so brilliant. That's a perfect example.
Yeah, so I just like laughed it off a bit awkwardly.
Yeah.
Then we were asked to put our post-it notes and our ideas onto the flip chart, and one of my colleagues then came up behind me and put his hands under my armpits and lifted me up so that I could reach the flip chart, thinking it was hilarious.
How do you feel when things like this happen? Because I know this was this week, but it can't have been the only time. The way that your tone of voice when you said I laughed it off...
The initial comment I laughed off. That one being touched and tickled was obviously a little bit of a shock. So
of course,
I basically told him to get off. I can't repeat the word that I did use.
No, you've got a bit of a problem with a potty mouth, Dave. We've already established that.
But yeah, it was quite belittling. Excuse the pun. I'm more than happy to accept banter, from friends and that. But within an office place. Felt it was totally inappropriate.
What did you do? Did you do anything about it?
I walked out of the meeting and went to get my car keys, then realised that I'd left my mobile phone on the desk within the meeting, so I had to gingerly walk back in, pick my phone up and walk back out and close the door. And I basically, I phoned the manager after and said, look, and I've got to take the afternoon off. I was absolutely boiling.
Oh.
Because it has happened. It had happened previously a number of times in work where the person did give me a little bit of banter. We've got a very banterish sort of relationship.
Yes, I understand.
Which I don't mind on a personal level when you want
one-on-one. One-on-one is very different to public, isn't it?
Done in front of other people. I've had other people, including my own manager, join in, which was totally inappropriate. I just feel it's just not appropriate in a workplace environment. People, very careful not to sort of refer to race, religion. We have, have all the training that that they do and that.
Of course.
But one thing which is not, it's just still. I think, as you say, the point you're getting is totally acceptable to take the Mickey.
Yes.
Out of.
Although that of course is potentially offensive to Irish people. I think taking the Mickey has its origin. I mean, it's better than what you said before, which we had to dump. Yeah. But I mean, it's illustrative of how language changes and how the perception of offence changes as well. I don't know what should take the rise out of out of you. I suppose is safe. Did you lodge an official complaint?
I haven't. No, I mean I know that I could do. I've got a great working relationship with the people I work with, and I don't want to
don't want to be that guy, do you? You don't want to be that guy.
No, I'm very self-deprecating. I know that I'm short. I've had jokes a million times.
But there's a line for everybody, isn't there, mate?
Yeah, there's a time and a place. There's a time and a place.
I'd have thought
my friends tonight, and they'll be probably pulling wise cracks, and I'm used to it. But they're my friends, and they can.
But there are some circumstances where you can't. I think physical intervention like that is a really big red line. I think that HR would almost certainly have something to say about that if you were to engage with them. But I just want to clarify, the well-being course that you were on would be both mental and physical well-being, would it?
Absolutely, yeah.
That's extraordinary. So you're on a mental well-being course and someone has decided to make you the butt of a heightist joke.
Which, again, it was an improvement. I've accepted the people involved's apology.
Oh, you have?
Dorna line. And,
oh, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and yeah. I think there is an obviously training issue. Some people, you know, may not realise the offence that they're causing.
You're a great ambassador for this cause, actually,
yeah.
Because you've described something that I think everybody listening is actually going to have an emotional reaction to. Even people who didn't understand why I was doing this subject in the first place are going to be thinking now, actually, do you know what? I didn't really know that what James was on about. I didn't think this was a particularly serious thing, but that's bang out of order what happened to Dave. There's no way people should be picking him up to make jokes, or indeed the person running the actual wellbeing course should be inviting everybody in the room to mock him publicly over his height. I mean, listen, it's your life and you've got used to some of the quotes, banter end quotes that you receive, but I think in a different universe, some of the stuff that you put up with and think is normal and acceptable wouldn't be. The way the pendulum swings on these issues is extraordinary. Let's look at the language that was normal on 1970s television to steer it back to other attributes like ethnicity or skin color. Colour and what is acceptable or not acceptable now. Thank you, mate. That was really, really helpful, actually. If you're wondering why we're talking about it, we're looking at complaints from... I think even complaint sounds whiny. It's like it's the Blackadder star Tony Robinson pointing out that it's still acceptable to make comments on men's lack of height. He's particularly exercised by women putting it in dating profiles as a kind of red line, but it draws our attention to precisely the kind of things that Dave has just picked up on. What about you? This idea of it being something that, if it were any other attribute, there'd be very little argument about it being unacceptable, but because it's height, particularly with reference to short men, it's somehow not clocked as a problem. It's somehow not seen as out of order. 0345 6060973 is the number you need. And I don't know that Dave needs any vindication, but quite a lot of people really taken aback by that. Claire says that's serious bullying in the workplace, the desk jibe and the lifting up. And Jim says he handled it better than I would have done. What a great guy. And because height is not a protected characteristic, some elements of the complaint would be quite hard to pin down, Bruce explains, but you could have a case under indirect discrimination, as height can be more prevalent than race or sex, and that's because women are usually shorter, as are some ethnicities. It's 12:30. Amelia Cox is here with your headlines.
Germany says it won't authorise any exports of military equipment which could be used in Gaza until further notice. It follows plans announced by the Israeli cabinet to take over Gaza City. The Foreign Secretary is holding talks with US Vice President J.D. Vance. They're expected to discuss Gaza and Ukraine at Chevening, which is David Lammy's official country residence in Kent. And people living near new pylons could get £250 a year off their energy bills for a decade. The government hopes the cash benefits would reduce local opposition to electricity infrastructure. LBC weather, outbreaks of rain for the northwest of Scotland, sunny spells and the odd shower elsewhere in Scotland and Northern Ireland, sunny for England and Wales, warmer in southeast England, a high of 26 degrees.
This is LBC.
Take my money.
You, and you gather in the name of chicken, for thou shalt not eat alone. The KFC popcorn bucket, 60 pieces for $5.99. Get the deal. Believe in chicken. KFC. Until 31st of August, subject to availability. Participating restaurants only. Not available on delivery. See website for full T's and C's.
Join us for the Mercedes-Benz Platinum Star event. From the 8th to the 18th of August, enjoy exclusive in-store savings when you order your new Mercedes-Benz and step into a world of refined luxury. From the all-electric EQS with intuitive MBUX hyperscreen to the GLE SUV's comfort-enhancing massaging seats, this is excellence redefined. Appointments are limited. Book yours today at your local showroom. T's and C's apply. Selected models subject to availability.
Lost World Play Barn, Dragon Castle Children's Farm, Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Froggy Stop Play. Tommy Tractor Play Barn, Quadapillar, Rowing Boats, Owl Displays, Meerkats, Honey Pot, Bears. Kids, put on your swimmers for Jungle Splash.
Yeah, let's go, Mum.
Right, Cannon Arena, Lemurs, Jungle Kingdom Go-Karts, Wave Runner 2, Magical Wood and Cafes.
Nutcatch Adventure Park.
Book now at knockcatch.com.
The new Big Arch has arrived at McDonald's. A burger so iconic, it's got its own sauce. A signature Big Arch sauce. sounds serious, doesn't it? It is. Seriously good. Big Arch. The big McDonald's hunger. Until 9th of September, from 11 a.m, participating restaurants only, subject to availability.
You know how fans shout at football matches?
Oh, wake up!
That's because sound is the most effective way to tell the players they're rubbish. Works in advertising too. Because when you amplify your advertising using radio, your campaign is 49% more likely to get noticed. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
James O'Brien on LBC.
12:32 is the time, and it's an interesting one. I think I was right, actually, when I suggested that you may not have taken this subject as seriously, because I didn't used to, and it's one of those things, oh, get over yourself. What are you going to be complaining about next? It's political correctness gone mad. But actually, yeah, Dave told that story so well that it's pretty hard to argue with the idea that people who are short men, get treated in ways that possessors of other attributes would never be treated anymore. I mean, they might once have been subjects of mockery, but it wouldn't work like that anymore. 12:33 is the time. Gary's in Edinburgh. Gary, what would you like to say?
Hi, good afternoon, James.
Hello, mate.
Yeah, I think, I would say I'm 5'5". Realistically, I'm probably 5'4½", but let's just round up while I'm truncating, you know?
I wonder what the threshold is at which you start counting the halves.
Yeah, exactly. That's born from my mother, actually. I think she's about 5'3½", but I think she's 5'3", you know? She's adding the extra half on, I'm just kidding, yeah. But I think, for me, I suppose even primary school, I've obviously been shorter all my life, because when I was born, I had a bit of a deficiency, so okay. It kind of led through my life. When it was nothing bad, I'm fine now, but
sure.
When I was 5 years old, I had the bone structure of a 3½-year-old.
Right.
And that kind of continues. When I was 10 years old, I had the bone structure of a 7-year-old. So I was always a little bit shorter than my peers.
Mm.
But in primary school, I was given the nickname Midge, like a tiny little, I suppose, nuisance fly, I guess, in Scotland.
But they didn't mean that, though, did they? I mean, it's also short for midget, which is another word that has come to change its meaning over the years.
But it
wouldn't have been said, well, you correct me if I'm wrong, but it wasn't said with malice.
No, not at all. It was a fun nickname, and that's what I was known by, on the football field, everything. Yeah. That's fine. And I suppose slight bullying started at high school, so from 12 years old onwards. And there was a guy that was very, very tall. And he said it was just constantly ribbing me in the playground. And I said something pretty harsh back. And, you know, as you're saying, height isn't a protected characteristic. Mm. What I said to him essentially is now. And, the thing is, I thought, right, I'm in for a doing here. And it just burst out in tears in front of me and his friends. And I thought, that's a weird reaction. I was expecting to get my head stoled in.
This is a classic hook and tease, except you're not going to be able to tell us what it was that you said to him.
No.
Was it about his mum?
No, it wasn't. No, right. It was about. Sorry, he's upbringing, shall we say? But
okay.
I remember his friend, who was roughly the same height as me, maybe half an inch taller.
Yeah.
Said he came to me and said, oh, "That's unfair. He can't change this." And I said, "Well, I can just change my height like that, can I?"
Yeah.
And I kind of stopped the bullying. And from that point on, I kind of dealt with it through humour. And I've always been brought up in a family where, my brothers and sister, my brothers are both taller than me and a bit older. I used to have a laugh at this stuff, and I knew how to take a ribbing, but then. Also, I've never ever really had an issue with dating. Well, so I mean, awkward timing now because I'm just recently single. But generally, I've never had an issue. And some of my most recent girlfriend, she's 5'11", and it's never been an issue. Like, I think once people get to know me, we have a laugh. And then I know it's a bit cliched, but they don't see the height.
Well, that's what Robinson is so cross about. Because, and I think cross is a fair comment actually. Because if a woman has on her dating profile, "I don't want short men" or "I don't want anyone under this age," then that's someone that could easily have fallen for you, but isn't giving you the time of day or isn't giving you the opportunity.
You've got to get on the field to have a game, you know.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You do, and they're not letting you.
Yeah, but it's never been that huge issue. I mean, hopefully I can offer some hope for
yeah, no,
for
listen, I don't, I mean, there. Crikey, it's going to be 90%, whatever the percentage of the time, it's not even going to be an issue, but it's just on those rare moments where it is. What would you have done if you were in Dave's situation in that wellbeing meeting last week when, I don't know if you heard all of the call, he's at a wellbeing meeting and the person taking it, he says it would be a good idea if we had standing desks. He's about your height. And she points at a non-standing desk and says, "So I suppose you're allowed to laugh." She points at a non-standing desk and says, "There you go, there's your standing desk." And everybody laughs at that. And then later on, when they're going to the flip chart to write things on it, one of his colleagues comes up behind him and picks him up. Like, actually physically picks him up. I don't know if you'd have been cool with that, would you?
No, the physical picking up, I mean, if someone's offering me a non-standing desk, I'd probably just say, I'd rather just sit down, thanks.
Yes.
Just for a bit of a laugh. But certainly the flip chart, that's almost, it's tantamount to assault, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's a bit much that. I would have been happy with that. I don't know how I would have dealt with it, really. I mean, it depends what their protected characteristics was, if I could say it in that group.
Well, yeah, and also on who it was and how it was, because something that might be funny in the pub 3 pints in or among your closest friends is not going to be funny, even if it's one of your closest friends who's also a colleague doing it in front of people that you don't have long-standing and deep relationships with it. I suppose, question, I hate it when the producer does this. You put on the screen, is it stupid to ask why it's not a protected characteristic? Well, if it is stupid to ask that, who is the one that's going to end up looking stupid, you or me? Well, now you, because I've pulled back the curtain like Toto in the final scene of The Wizard of Oz. But I don't think it is stupid to ask why, presumably just because of numbers, is it? And quite hard to, I mean, what would you do? You'd have to put a number on it. You'd have to say below this and above that. So I don't know. I mean, maybe it should be. Thank you, Gary. Stay safe. Ben's in Chessington. Ben, what would you like to say?
Good afternoon to you, James. Thank you for bringing this subject up.
You're very welcome.
So I'm fit for your research. I'm 5'5¾".
Right.
And I always had 3/4 on because it sounds better. But
does it, though?
Yes. Yeah. It's more numbers involved, isn't
it? Yeah, all right. Yeah, it's like qualifications on a business card, isn't it?
Yeah.
The more letters you got, the cleverer you are. Go on.
Yeah. So, a couple of points. I was born with a condition called NF, neurofibromatosis.
Right.
And one of those things was I started growing up early.
Okay.
Physically, mentally as well. But I'm 5'5" now, and with all my friends then, it's primary school, junior school, I was always much taller than them.
Okay.
And then I sort of slowed down as I got to my teenage years. But a couple of things. You're right about the dating apps where I just try to leave my height off. You go to meet someone and they go, oh, I didn't realise you were that short. And it's
straight away.
Yeah, yeah. But my workplace, I work with in a military environment as a civilian.
Okay.
And my boss and I, we have such good bands, and he calls me his fat little friend, which... he's short as well. I said, oh, we're two of the seven dwarfs, sir. And because in that environment, I've got used to the military environment, and it doesn't...
I think this is probably part of the reason why it's not a protected characteristic, isn't it? Because it is so fluid, and in some circumstances, something can actually be not just acceptable, but welcome, because it's funny and affectionate. And in other circumstances, it would be the same kind of behaviour or the same kind of language would be profoundly offensive.
Yeah, I mean, because I work in a very small team, and there's only 3 or 4 of us, but... the gentleman who was on that call.
Hang on a minute. What do you mean 3 or 4 of you? You're in a you must know how many people are in it.
in my office,
numbers are important, Ben. Numbers are important.
we just make fun of each other all the time. And he ever says to me, if ever I cross the line, do tell me. So we got that.
Fair enough. So it's up to you. And you would have the confidence to say so. You wouldn't feel silly saying that's a bit unfair, mate, or wind your neck.
Yeah.
You've crossed the line. What about when you turn up on a date and the woman says immediately, I didn't realise you were that short. Can I ask how you deal with that? How do you handle that?
One of my responses was, oh, I didn't realise how big your nose was.
I don't know if I should even laugh. Well, I laugh at what I find funny, to be honest.
Yeah.
But how did she take it?
Not
great. Did she have a big nose?
Yes. Change your nose. I can't change my height.
Not married then?
No.
That's not how I met your mother story, is it? But actually, on a more serious note, what you highlight is that what you did is widely regarded as unacceptable, and yet what she did is widely regarded as acceptable, and to a neutral observer, they're both as offensive as each other.
Yeah, I mean, if a man was to ask a woman her weight, she was slightly overweight, that's taken great offence by that. But you see these things on Facebook videos, would you date a short guy? No. Step on these scales, because I wouldn't date a heavy girl. But that doesn't bother me if a woman's overweight. And, maybe there's some overweight women on here who want to date a short guy. I don't know. But I just think you're right. It's something which... people do suffer from, or you can't reach the shelf, or do you want to, things like that, which,
yes.
If, yeah.
Yes, yeah. No, it is. It's there, but people deal with it, don't they? People move through it. Thank you. Thank you, Ben. That's lovely. It's coming up to 12:43 and nailing it, really. I've got to do quite a weird apology. I've just had a lovely message. During my interview with Graham Fellows recently, actually, let me just double check on that one before, but it's not a proper apology. It's just something quite, I think I've made an identity error with two rather brilliant actors. One of whom's just been kind enough to drop me a note in the middle of Ben's phone call, which temporarily and very, very briefly distracted me. There you go. That's a little mystery for you. Shall we do an I need to get the blooming headline. Shall we do what? Do you want to do? I think we should.
Unhinged headline.
I'm sorry. You're going to have to do this one. Is absolutely nuts. You're going to have to do that again, Keith.
Unhinged headline.
Brexit has been a success for us, but Labour is determined to kill it. Writes David Frost, of course, a very, very strong Remainer, who, as the head of the Scotch whisky trade body in Scotland, was very passionate and occasionally even quite intelligent sounding about the importance of staying in the European Union in the run-up to the referendum. But then something weird happened, and he came out a few years later as Boris Johnson's biggest cheerleader. He had a seat in the House of Lords, and he actually negotiated the deal that he miraculously is claiming has been a great success for us, despite the fact that they were trying to disown it before the ink had even dried. And if as unhinged headlines go, that is pretty unhinged. Thank you.
Unhinged headlines.
It's been a while, hasn't it, since we've got back into the zone lately on the unhinged headlines, but we've got to start trying to find some that aren't in the comment pages of the Daily Telegraph, because it seems unlikely that they have a full monopoly, a complete monopoly on all things unhinged. I've also got in the next part of the programme a little clip of this week's Full Disclosure for you that features Kevin Rowland. You probably know. If you don't know him by name, you should. But he's the lead singer of Dexys Midnight Runners and has written a rather splendid new memoir, which has stormed its way into the Sunday Times top 10, and who makes for an extraordinary guest on Full Disclosure. An incredible life, lurching from Top of the Pops to homelessness and drug addiction, and then back to Top of the Pops isn't on anymore, then back to the Hit Parade, and indeed the top 10 book chart, all in the space of a single lifetime that is far from over, happily.
Coming up at 1, Sheila Fogarty, leading Britain's conversation, next on LBC.
Pump 6 in this meal deal, please.
Let's play Rate My BP Meal Deal.
Okay.
You chose an M&S chicken and bacon pasta, Magnum ice cream and a Wild Bean Cafe iced latte. That's a 10. A perfect warm weather combo.
Am I on a holiday?
No. BP Meal Deal. One deal, millions of combinations. All for £6. T's and C's apply, subject to availability at BP M&S stores only. For details, see bp.com/latest offers.
Car owners, you could be owed thousands in compensation. If you bought a car on finance from 2007 onwards, it may have been sold with hidden commissions. Text CLAIM to 86688. My Claim Group. Authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. You don't need to use a CMC. You can claim direct to your lender and the Financial Ombudsman for free. Text CLAIM to 86688.
Claims made simple.
Save this summer with Lidl Plus. Get 2 for £7 on burgers, jumbo sausages and more. And get 2 for £3.50 on our plant burgers, veggie sausages and more veggie classics. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this summer today.
18 plus TV only while stocks last. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
Body pain might not sound like this.
Oh.
Or this.
Oh.
But it might sound like this.
I'm fine.
Hiding your body pain behind a smile? Let us help. With up to 12 hours of uninterrupted muscle and joint pain relief. Voltarol, the joy of movement. Voltarol Joint and Back Pain Relief 2.3% gel contains diclofenac diethylammonium. Always read the label.
Have you ever wondered what a sandwich sounds like? Not much to it, is there? Unless, of course, it's a Walker's sandwich. Mmm, that is good. Now that's what a sarnie should sound like. Go all crisp in with Walker's. Delicious.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. tea. Tap up on island fuel. Rest every 2 hours too. I inspect tire pressure and tread. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with TRIP.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
It is 12:47, and let's do the full disclosure thing first, actually, before we get back to the phones. It's been really lovely lately. I told you, I know this sounds a little bit self-regarding, but I promise you it isn't. It's just such a lovely collection of interviews, and you sit down for a long period of time. I sometimes lose track of which ones have been released and which ones haven't. So either imminently or in the very recent past, there's some really, really lovely interviews with people who I don't always get the space and time to speak at length and in depth, because our media's not built for it. Outside of podcasts, you know, you get 5 minutes on a radio show or 3 minutes on a TV show. One I didn't push hard enough was with Graham Fellows, who perhaps is best known to you, depending on your age, as either John Shuttleworth or possibly Jilted John, the singer of Gordon Is a Moron, which in and of itself is the beginning of a fascinating story, and which even my daughters know that song, and it came out when long, long, long before they were born. And I'm just going to mention, because I love things like this, in the course of my interview with Graham Fellows, he mentioned the actor Philip Jackson, and I obviously jumped to entirely the wrong conclusion and thought of, I'm pretty sure, I was thinking of Philip Franks. So in order, and I do this sometimes in interviews when I'm keen to establish my own showbiz credentials. So I would have said something like, oh yes, of course, he's a big director now, and he was in Darling Buds of May, wasn't he? He wasn't, that was Philip Franks. So I got my Jackson and my Franks mixed up. So thank you to Philip Jackson for dropping me a lovely text saying, regarding your podcast with the wonderful Graham Fellows, I don't direct now and I wasn't in Darling Buds. Yeah, but apart from that, Philip, what did I get wrong? Come on, nobody's perfect. Anyway, here's this week's full disclosure with the rather splendid Kevin Rowland, most definitely not Kevin Bacon.
You mentioned being Catholics, you were an altar server, you went the whole nine yards, didn't you? You did the whole Catholic church.
I got right into the church thing, yeah. I loved it.
I was Catholic. I raised Catholic as well. Again, in a sort of second, third generation Irish family. But when other people read that he thought about being a priest, he dreamed of training to be a priest, they sort of go, wow, that's a bit weird. But for kids raised in the Catholic, I think every boy went through a period of thinking that he possibly had a calling to be a priest.
I think so. And we're given quite a lot of encouragement, really.
You want to sign us up quick. More so now.
If you're breathing, you're in. But they didn't let me in.
Well, you didn't try very hard to get into it, did you?
I tried pretty hard. I did the Latin lessons every Saturday morning, but I was pretty slow on it. And I went as far as meeting the bishop in Birmingham. We got the bus to Birmingham, me and my mum. We met the bishop. I sat the exam. But the trouble was, simultaneously, I'd been getting quite a lot of trouble at school, and I'm sure they would have written to the head nun for a reference, who had already told my mum I was going to be going nowhere, you know.
Well, that was a recurring theme in your childhood, that you were going to go nowhere.
Yeah.
And your dad joined in a bit sometimes.
Very much.
Why was that?
I have no idea.
What was it about you that made him and others think that you were destined for, well, either jail, actually, at some point?
Yeah. I mean, it was very confusing, because the first time he said it, I was 8 years old. And he said,
you remember it?
Yeah, I remember it well. We were sitting around, and I think it was my sister asked the question, what do you think I'll be when I grow up, Dad? You'll be a teacher. What do you think I'll be, when my brother said? What do you think I'll be, Dad? You'll be a businessman. What about me, Dad? And he just got serious. He went, you'll be married with a kid when you're 17. And I pretended to not know what he meant, but I did know what he meant. Because my older brother had already told me about babies and stuff.
Mm.
I mean, many years later, when I first stopped taking drugs, you know, and I was doing some therapy and trying to work everything out and trying to get well, I realised I needed to go and talk to my dad. And with the therapist, we worked out a strategy, and I went home and I said to my dad, Dad, am I like you? And he went, nah. I said, nothing like you. Nah, nothing like me. I said, well, who am I like? He said, you're a McDonald. That's my mum's side.
Gosh.
And I said, what were they like? And this therapist was clever at work. He said, well, I wonder what your dad's relationship was like with them. So I said to my dad, how did you get on with them? And he said, yeah, all right. But they thought they were better than everyone else. And they thought I wasn't good enough for my mum.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's amazing how often therapy comes up in Full Disclosure. That's probably because I like talking about it so much myself, but goodness me, it shines back at you sometimes. That's a beautiful interview, that. Not because of anything I did, but just because Kevin is such a fascinating and complex man who's lived such an interesting life. And it's a lovely curve. The narrative arc of his story is lovely because he's in a much, much better place now, at the age, I think, of 70, than he ever was before, even when he was enjoying huge success with Dexy's Midnight Runners. I really recommend that one. And I also, because I didn't get to push it much at the time, I can't remember why, either I was away, I think I might have been away, or it was released on a day when the news had overtaken us completely and we didn't have time to plug it. But go back and have a listen to the Graham Fellows one as well. Just don't get Philip Jackson mixed up with Philip Franks, whatever you do. Only a fool would do that. Back to Tony Robinson, another previous guest on Full Disclosure. I told you it was good. And his complaints about the ease with which picking on short men is accommodated within society. Women, actually, it's a matter of record that women prefer a larger height difference between themselves and male partners. The University of Groningen in the Netherlands looked into this a few years ago and found that the ideal gap was 21 centimetres, where men actually preferred an 8 centimetres. So men want to be 8 centimetres taller than a female partner. And women actually quite like the idea of having a man who's 21 centimetres taller, which provides a pseudo-scientific background, or possibly even a scientific background, to the prejudice that we are talking about. Brent's in Derby. Brent, what would you like to say?
Hello, James. As a sufferer of the Napoleonic complex...
You're not an angry man, Brent, surely. You're not, are you?
Oh, I tick every box with it. I've had it all my life. And I still get people coming up to me going, how tall are you? And I'm like, 168 centimetres. And the amount of times I've had people go, you know, let's go back to back. Or you get girls walking up with 6-inch heels going, you're really short, aren't you? And you feel like saying, you're really overweight. You can't say that.
No, of course you can't. Ben did. Ben told a woman she had a big nose when he was on a date and she commented on his height. And the thing is, you're right, you quotes can't say that, end quotes, but why can you say to someone you're really short, aren't you? It's really weird, isn't it?
It is, and it's historically a taboo as well, because I mean, leaders have always, you take Macron got teased for it, Rishi Sunak got teased for it, and in fact some of the greatest leaders in history have been the Napoleonic complex, people who have been bullied because, and I'm going to be honest, part of my personality is a direct result of the bullying, the teasing. And even the way I play sport, I do conform to the kind of scrappy-do, Marty McFly, every sort of short man. Even poor Baldrick, the guy saying the comment was actually bullied in the comedy series because of his shortness, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
He looked down upon.
So you go in, you go in hard when you're in those kind of scenarios.
But it goes the other way as well. I have a friend, when I go out, he's 6'5", I'm 5'6".
Yeah.
And he gets the other end. He gets called crouchy. He gets, you know, what's the weather like up there? See, I think extremes of height, because there are people who are probably on the other end of it, the extreme height, tall people who get, are you a basketballer? And, you know, I don't play basketball. And he always gets teased. So the two of us look like Rodney and Del Boy out of Only Fools and Horses when we're standing there, because the height differential gets...
When does it hurt? When does it hurt, Brent? Because, I'm speaking to a lot of lads who've clearly mastered the art of shrugging it off or turning it into a joke, but sometimes it gets under your armour, as it were. When does it hurt?
It hurts when I see it perpetuated with my own children. I married a 4'11", and my daughter is the smallest in the class.
Right.
And she's already getting teased. And the thing is, I'm developing her resilience and her personality bit
by
bit. Okay, you're small on a football pitch. So she's almost, and this history repeating itself, she's running around like Scrappy doing a football pitch, and I'm thinking, oh, have I passed on? But then I look at my dad's 5'6", my mum's 4'11".
Right.
So the gene pool of our family is quite small and determined. And I think partly because we get judged on our height. And it's just one of those things you think that people are mean about it.
Yes.
And sometimes it becomes the thing they define you by rather than your personality or your person. And it can be very hurtful when people just judge you, strangers especially. They don't know you and they go,
no.
you're really short, aren't you?
Yeah. That's why the dating app stuff is mean, isn't it? Because they don't know you at all. There's so much more to all of us than our flipping height. But people see past my height in a way that they won't see past yours.
And there's nothing I can do about that. It's not as if I can stretch myself. It's not as if I can go and and do something that's genetically what I was born with, in the same way you're born with your skin colour, or for gingers, God bless the gingers of this world, they get it too, don't they? Because I mean, the thing is, you can dye your hair, you can lose some weight, you can dye your hair, but I can't stretch my body out to look taller, can I?
No, nor should you. But in many ways, your daughter's lucky to have you to show her the way. You know, there'll be some things in life that your parents don't have much experience of that you're finding tricky to deal with. I like that, Brent. Thank you, mate. Apologies to Ben, who's waiting to talk to us, and to Naomi and Sylvia as well. But it's kind of run its course. And I did promise to tell you the story. I should have done a little bit more on this sooner. But do you know who Rupert Lowe is? I almost hesitate to tell you who he is in case you're lucky enough not to know. I'd feel like I'd done you a grave disservice. He's one of the people that has managed to somehow be too bad for reform. Is it half of their MPs or two-thirds? Anyway, a significant proportion of the MPs that came into Parliament under Nigel Farage's auspices at the last election are no longer in Nigel Farage's party. One of them, of course, was not thrown out of the party when it emerged that he'd been locked up for battering a former girlfriend. I can't remember what the other one did, Rupert Lowe, but anyway, he's beyond even that somehow. Anyway, he was on social media yesterday claiming that dinghies were coming into Great Yarmouth right now, which suggests he's the MP for Great Yarmouth. It suggests he's never actually looked at the town on a map. Where the hell would they have come from? Also, the boat that he was shouting about was going parallel to the coast. So, as if it didn't want to land on the beach. But he's calling the RNLI. I think he might have called the police. I'm not sure. The unknown vessel. What did he tweet? Something like that. Deport everybody now, or words to that effect. And it was actually... it was a crew of fundraisers for a charity raising money to research into MND that was led by a former Royal Marine. So even when he was calling for the Royal Navy to turn up, the fellow who actually led the expedition, Mike Bates, a British record holder for rowing across the Atlantic Soho, pointed out that the best comment was the one asking where the Royal Navy were when you need them. I'm a former Royal Marine, so the Royal Navy were on the boat. And that's why, to solve the mystery of this morning, I was reminding myself of exactly where Great Yarmouth is on the map of England. And they wouldn't have needed a dinghy to make that journey. They'd have needed at least a motor cruiser. But hey-ho. Mind how you go. That's it for another day. If you missed any of today's show, then you can listen back on Catch Up on Global Player and the LBC app, where you can stay up to date on all the top stories and opinions. You can put your news categories in the order you want. You can pause and rewind live radio. Listen to a range of podcasts such as James O'Brien Daily, an hour of the best bits from my show every day. I know what you're thinking. How the hell do they get it down to a single hour? Download the official LBC app from your store.
I think you can't advertise your own stuff.
Of course you can. It's,
no, I know.
My middle name.
I know you can.
Have you read my book yet? Don't say no more. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Tom Swarbrick. But now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you very much indeed. Really love that hour on height. Yeah, being a tall
stuff,
girl.
Wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it really was. Yeah. Three today. So many of you, not particularly about migration, although including migration, have complained that Labour doesn't get its message across strongly enough, and you don't quite know what they stand for. Well, I don't know if you've seen this video today of deportations taking place of people who've come over in boats, or preparations for deportations. Tough talk as well from Keir Starmer. It's kind of Trump-style video. If you come by boat, you face detention and return. Do you approve of this kind of political messaging? I'm going to start, though, with the MP Rushanara Ali's resignation over her actions as a landlord. Should it mean that wider change for MPs who rent out second and third properties should stop?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, Germany says it won't authorise any exports of military equipment that could be used in Gaza. Chancellor Friedrich Merz says it's increasingly difficult to see how Israel's goals to eradicate Hamas will be achieved. Last night, Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet agreed plans to take full control of the strip. Yaakov Katz is former editor of the Jerusalem Post. He's told LBC the condemnation of Israel makes a ceasefire even less likely.
What this does is it emboldens Hamas. It makes Hamas believe that what it's doing is working. So when they hear that they might get unilateral recognition of a Palestinian state come September at the United Nations by Britain, they say to themselves, why should we stop the war? It's working.
A schoolboy who stabbed another pupil to death on their lunch break has been found guilty of murder. 15-year-old Harvey Wilgoose was stabbed in the heart by another teenager who'd brought a hunting knife to school. The defendant, who is also 15, can't be named because he's under 18. LBC's reporter in Yorkshire, Alex Taylor-Brown, has been following the case at Sheffield Crown Court.
There were cries of yes from Harvey's family in the public gallery upon the verdict, as well as tears from the defendant's family as well. The courts heard that the defendant had an obsession with weapons. This has taken its toll, really, on all those involved. This has been a six-week trial. Incredibly emotional at times, hearing from all sorts of witnesses, and Harvey's family have been here every day.
The US Vice President is meeting the Foreign Secretary at his official country residence in Kent. J.D. Vance and David Lammy are expected to discuss Gaza and Ukraine at evening. People living near newly built electricity pylons could get £250 a year off their energy bills for a decade. The government plans are intended to overcome local opposition to new overhead lines. It will apply to homes within 500 metres of pylons. And a yellow heat health alert has been issued across parts of England next week. The warning from the UK Health Security Agency will last from midday on Monday until Wednesday evening. It means officials are expecting health and care services to come under pressure. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 3 points at 90.96. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather: outbreaks of rain for the northwest of Scotland, sunny spells and the odd shower elsewhere in Scotland and Northern Ireland. Sunny for England and Wales, warmer in southeast England, a high of 26 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search "Don't Get Caught Out".
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. In light of that breaking news of a 15-year-old boy having been found guilty of murdering a fellow pupil, Harvey Wilgoose, we will reflect on that story a little later this hour. But I want to start with the story of Rushanara Ali, the now ex-homelessness minister. We talked about the story yesterday. She resigned yesterday as well. It's been confirmed that she's gone. It comes after she was accused of hypocrisy over the way she handled rent increases on a house that she owns in East London. Now, Vicky Spratt is the housing correspondent at the I newspaper and author of Tenants, the People on the Front Line of the Housing Emergency. She had this exclusive story that we all followed yesterday. And there's been this development as well. So Vicky joins me, as does Aggie Chambray, LBC's political correspondent. Vicky, good afternoon to you. Did you think this was an inevitable resignation once you broke that story?
As soon as I heard from the tenants when they contacted me, I thought, if this checks out, it's a resigning matter.
And just remind people of the story who might be picking it up today for the first time.
So I was contacted about a week ago by the friend of somebody who had rented one of Rushanara Ali's rental properties. It was a four-bedroom townhouse in East London. The people living in it were all young professionals in their 20s and 30s. They moved in last March. Around 8 months into their tenancy, they were told that the house was going to be sold, so their tenancy would not be being renewed and they would have to move out. They went into a panic trying to find other places to live. They left in March this year, so at the end of their tenancy, and they saw that the property had been relisted very shortly after that for nearly £700 a month more in rent.
Vicky, there's a lot of noise in the background. Is it possible?
I'm sorry, I'm actually moving. I'm moving house today, so I did warn you guys.
There might be some noise. All right. Another housing story, Vicky.
Surrounded by boxes, I'm afraid.
That's all right.
And of course,
carry on.
£700 more a month. These people have all had to move. They were also charged by agents acting on Ali's behalf nearly £2,000 for repainting. They didn't pay that in the end. That's a breach of the Tenant Fees Act. Now, the former minister didn't break any existing laws. Nothing that she did was unlawful. But under Labour's own renters' rights bill, when that becomes law next year, landlords will be prohibited from saying they are selling a home and asking tenants to leave and then relisting it within 6 months for any rent, but certainly not for a higher rent.
And so it would become illegal down the line. As you say, it isn't yet, but it beggars belief that somebody in her position with three properties in total, one that she shares with a family member and two others that she rents out, would be given this role of homelessness minister.
Homelessness minister. I mean, let's be fair to the government. She wasn't the minister responsible for renters reform. That's Matthew Pennycook. But at the same time, there is a direct link, in the government's own words, between the ending of a private tenancy and homelessness. So you have to wonder why they weren't checking whether the people at the department dealing with this flagship landmark legislation were landlords.
Aggie, come in on this. Aggie Chambray, LBC's political correspondent, because a couple of things here. Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, said yesterday on LBC, her understanding was that she hadn't broken any of the current rules on declaring your interests and the like. And yet the government, Downing Street, still saw fit to give her a job in homelessness. That's a political mistake, isn't it?
Well, I think the point is, and Vicky was just explaining this, she hadn't broken any rules. So the problem, and what was pointed out by numerous people yesterday that makes this story extremely difficult for her, is that the things she did in the tenants leaving, her then hiking the rent by £700 while saying she was selling the house and then saying the house didn't sell, that would become illegal under the legislation that the government is putting forward in the Renters' Rights Bill that's going to come into force next year. So the point of that is basically either what she did was wrong or the legislation that the government is